Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, January 15, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 515-604-9386, and our participant code is 419-303. If your cell call provider blocks or charges for the call, you can call our backup number, which is 781-838-3728. And by the way, that information is out on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on the weekly call on the top left side, right above the bar, the blue bar. And all that information and all the calls that have been recorded since the beginning, since our inception, is up there. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. That's plural. Questions, plural. nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. You can click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. And please, anybody who's hearing these messages and these meetings and participating, whatever, everybody needs to participate and get involved. You know, we're going to have a power vacuum in Washington soon. You know, the deep state, the swamp is almost drained, I think, and I think things are ready to happen, but we'll see. And once that happens, there's going to be a power vacuum that must be filled by we the people. If that power vacuum remains open too long, you know, we're just going to be filled. It's going to fill in with a bunch of the same people we had before. It'll only be a matter of time. Look, Trump can work what he's got to work to get us to the point that we can take control. Now it's up to us to take control. We have to be vigilant. We must be vigilant. So please, get involved. Do something. Get a committee of safety going locally. And also, please, donate $5 a month or more. We need money in order to continue the things that we're doing. We have a lot of things we want to do in the court, and we can't do it because we don't have the funds. And nobody could do it as cheap as us. Any group of people that want to do anything in the courts to file something, it might cost them $100,000. It'll cost us $1,000 because we're not a bunch of lawyers. You know, they're going to eat up most of that in some kind of a profit, and then they're going to lose the case anyway because they can never win this case on statutes. And bar attorneys are statutory. We must win this issue on the common law and Article III courts, and we must define and control the discussion. Okay, so we need to do this. So again, we need the monetary support, and we also need the people support. We have lots and lots of positions, thousands of positions open to be filled across this nation to take control so that we the people can be the consenters of our government. We need to consent at the judiciary level to make sure that the court is a court of justice and not a court of injustice is what it is today. We need it to be a court of justice, and only the people can control that. We have found the process by which we the people can control that, get involved and become one of the people to consent to our, you know, our government on the judicial level. We also need people involved on the political side of things, not with the politics and the BS, but with the Constitution and with the whole true political process of America is all about and how it works. We need to control that. We need to make sure that the people coming into office are people who are constitutionalists, who have read the Constitution, who have taken a course in the Constitution, and can answer questions concerning the Constitution. And only if the people take control and require that kind of a thing can it happen. So we have the committeeman process, which will be something that will develop from the committees of safety. The committees of safety will eventually morph into the committeeman process, just like our founding fathers did. Everybody needs to get involved. Everybody, no matter what you're doing, you should be involved supporting your committee of safety. Even if you can't make it to all their meetings and make it a couple of meetings a year, that could be good enough to some degree. But we need commitment. commitment on a national level. We need commitment mostly on the grassroots level, because what we're trying to do is push all the power and the authority back down to the grassroots. That's what National Liberty Alliance is all about, to push the power and the authority back to the people on a grassroots level. And if a people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. We have to be vigilant. We have to be. We have to understand the Constitution. This is not a difficult thing. A lot of people are frightened away from our Constitution or from the law or for going into courts because they've been brainwashed to believe, you know, it's too difficult. And to some degree it is. If you're going to get into the statutory process of things, you're going to have all this legalese and who knows what means what, when and how. On Tuesday, it's different than on Thursday, however they interpret whatever it is. They make the rules and the laws as they go along. Common law is not that way. It is cut and dry and clear. It is clear as crystal, and it's very simple. Constitution was written very clearly and simply, okay? And the most important part of the Constitution is understanding Article 1, 2, and 3, the powers and what powers they have and what powers that we have not given them, they do not have. And also the ruler of the Constitution was the Bill of Rights. We read everything in light of the Bill of Rights. If it's repugnant in any way to anything in the Bill of Rights, it's null and void. And it's very simple. This is not difficult. The process and procedures of the court are really pretty simple and logical. Once you go through to understand how to get into a court, how to defend yourself in a court, and what the paperwork, how the paperwork works, you're going to agree. This is simple stuff. This is not complex, so please don't be frightened away from getting involved with what we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance, whether it be on the political or the judicial side of things. We must control our courts, and we must control our political process. We must be able and have the ability and knowledge and understanding on how we can recall these people if they're not being obedient to the Constitution, or indict them if they're not being obedient to the Constitution. One can take 24 hours to pull them out of office, and the other one will take 90 days. But this is what we, the people, need to do. You got to get involved. We have to be diligent here. So everybody needs to get involved. So let's be supportive of what we're doing here, and definitely we need the financial support. Okay, we got some scripture reading. I lost my page here. Let's see. We're going to be reading the next section, which is Matthew chapter 22. We're going to be reading verses 1 through 14. Chapter 22, verses 1 through 14. And Jesus answered and spake unto them again a parable and said, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king which made a marriage for his son and sent forth his servants to call them that were bidden to the wedding, and they would not come. Again, he sent forth other servants, saying, tell them which are bidden, behold, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen and my fatlings are killed, and all things are ready. Come unto the marriage. But they made light of it, and went their way, one unto his farm, another to his merchandise. And the remnant took his servant, and entered them, and treated them spitefully, and slew them. But when the king heard thereof, he was wroth, and he sent forth his armies, and destroyed those murderers, and burnt up their cities. Then said he to his servants, the wedding is ready, but they which were bidden were not worthy. Go ye therefore into the highways, and as many as ye shall find, bid to the marriage. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all as many as they found, both bad and good, and the wedding was furnished with guests. And when the king came to see the guest, he saw there a man which had not on a wedding garment. And he saith unto him, friend, how comest thou in hither, and not having a wedding garment? And he was speechless. And then said the king to the servants, bind him hand and foot, and put him and take him away, and cast him into the outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen. Matthew chapter 22, verses 1 through 14. Okay, again, just real quick, you know, we have the campaign for constitutional sheriffs. We need all of our membership to go over there and join and become members over there also. to get that membership up and going. And we're also asking everyone to give $5 a month over there or more in order to get that project moving, because right now it's kind of running very, very slowly. We need, that's a money project. We need money for that. We need $40,000 approximately. We don't have the exact number, but I'm pretty sure I remember somewhere around 40 grand to get all of these booklets printed up and sent out to the sheriffs. And this is an extremely important project. If we don't educate our sheriffs, we don't have good constitutional protectors. That's the sheriff's job, is to protect and defend the Constitution, to make sure that we're not abused by our government. You know, if we have constitutional sheriffs that understand their job and understand the Constitution, they will make sure that no federal agency or state agency, for that matter, come into their territory, into their county, without first coming to see them if they want to exercise some kind of a warrant or something. It's the sheriff's duty to make sure that that is a lawful warrant, to make sure that there's a sworn affidavit and a signature of a judge, to make sure that due process goes forward. The sheriff will, and will always, if he understands his job, he will prevent the IRS from coming in seizing anything from the people, because they never come with the proper paperwork. And the reason they don't come in with the proper paperwork is because they can't. They can't take control through due process. So they have to go around it, a non-judicial process. Sheriffs will stop the IRS liens. Sheriffs will stop the IRS arrests. Sheriffs will stop the SWAT teams from breaking out our doors in the middle of the night and terrorizing us and our families and shooting our dog and maybe even us. Sheriffs will and can stop that once they understand and know the Constitution. Non-judicial foreclosures, non-judicial tax foreclosures, non-judicial mortgage foreclosures will become a thing of the past, will never happen again, once the county sheriff understands the law of the land. And they can never come to take your home away through due process, because they don't have the authority to do it, and they can't do it. We're not going to get into the details. We've done that before. But they cannot take your property for taxes. They cannot take your property for mortgage foreclosures in a legal way. That's why they have to do non-judicial foreclosures. We need to stop this. The sheriff can stop this. I don't want to say this is the most important project, because it isn't. The most important project ultimately is the people to take control of their courts. That is the most important problem, thing that we have to take care of. Nothing is more important than the people consenting to our judicial process. No, you can't indict that person. No, you can't put that person in jail. No, you can't find them. No, we disagree with you. Go away. Or yes, you can, because we agree with you. But ultimately, it's up to the sheriff to bring people before the grand jury. It's up to the sheriff to call the grand jury. Sure, the courts can call them if they want. There is a statutory process written up on how they can go about doing that. And then they try to tell us, well, wait a second, you have to go through a statutory process to call a grand jury. No, that was put them for them so they can have that call. They still have to come to us and to our feet, and we have to say yay or nay to the indictment. But they control the whole process. They really puppetize the juries. Okay, every jury is tainted. I don't think there's any jury out there in maybe 50 or 100 years. I don't know, quite some time, that hasn't been tainted, grand jury or trial jury. And sometimes we do get justice from our juries because they are able to see beyond it. Okay, but all too often, they really don't get to see beyond the restrictions that they've been put upon. They don't know that they have the power of nullification. They could say no to the law. We disagree. That's wrong. No, you're not going to have that. We must take control of our nation. We must give consent to our government, and it starts in the judiciary. The most important place is the judiciary, because that's the place they can destroy you. And they have. They've been destroying we the people for over 50 years in what they think is their judiciary, where a judge comes up and talks about his court. No, it's not his court. It's the king's court. It's the people's court, not his court. We need to correct that when a judge says a statement like that. But nevertheless, we need to take control of that. We need to take control of our political process. We need to get constitutionalists elected into office, people who know the Constitution, people who, when they do put up their hand, understand what they're saying when they make that sworn statement that they'll protect and preserve that Constitution. We need people who know what oath they're taking and then do it. We also need people to understand when they're not doing it, and we need to indict them. And that's where, we need an education. If you're not taking our courses here at National Liberty Alliance, you need to be doing that. You need to be taking that constitutional course. You need that civics course. And then you need that higher education. Not everybody's going to go for that higher education, but you should go for that higher education. Knowledge is power, and we must control the process. And if we don't control the process of consent through consent, and this is how we do it, through our juries and our committeemen, people don't realize the real power that is there. We consent to everything they do, everything, whether they're taking a vote, in the legislative houses, or if the judge is trying to make some kind of a decision somewhere, the courts are trying to move somewhere, we can control that. We can stop it. If we understand the power and the authority we have through those two processes alone, everybody needs to get involved in those two processes, at least one of those two processes. So we need to take back America. Okay. New York SAFE Act lawsuit. We started this about a week or two ago. Anybody interested in getting into this? Here in New York State, at the end of this month, they're coming to take your guns. If you're from New York and you're listening here, they're coming to take your guns. If you do not register, if you do not register with the state, doesn't matter that you have a permit with the sheriff anymore, if you do not register with the state here in New York State, they're coming for your guns eventually. And I heard a radio advertisement about this today on the news or something. New York has moved to on the 31st. If you haven't registered your guns with the state on the 31st, anybody who got their permits before 2013, I think it was January 2013, need to come and register by January 31st. That seems to be in conflict with a paper what I got in the mail, which said that you need to register before your date. For instance, if you got your permit in February or March or June, then you have to register by June 2018 or March of 2018. At least that's what it seems to say on my paperwork. I'll have to look a little closer on that, but I heard the news reporting different, that everybody had to have this done by January 31st. And if you don't get it done, you're on their hit list. They're coming to your house. They're going to be knocking on your doors collecting your guns. So what are we going to do about that? Are we going to allow these tyrants to come into our homes and take our guns? They may be met by violence in some areas. I don't know. But this is a major problem. We need to do something. We need to get this into the courts. And we got the papers already written. For anybody who wants to read the papers, go up to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. Once you get there, highlight the news. Okay, and underneath the news, it's 1, 2, 3 down, you'll see New York SAFE Act lawsuit. Read this and get involved, okay? Anybody can get involved in this lawsuit, okay? Anyone from New York, that is. You don't have to be an owner of a weapon, but you have to preserve your right. If you haven't taken up a weapon yet and you want to take one up next year, you're going to have a problem if we don't preserve our rights today. So listen, we need to preserve this. Once they take their guns, it is over. So we can't allow them to do this. But anyway, the paper is written. You can get up here and read it. We're also going to be doing an injunction. It's also in the paperwork. When you come down a little bit, you'll see read the Second Amendment action at law. This is our second draft. There's going to be a few more changes before we're ready to file. Hopefully, we're going to be ready to file very, very soon. It depends on accumulating money to go forward. We're asking anybody who signs in as a plaintiff to give $50. Okay, in order to cover our costs. And we are suing for a monetary damages of $50,000 for every plaintiff. So if you want to become a plaintiff and get the $50,000 in damages that we the people deserve, then you need to get into this case. But we are fighting this case not only for the plaintiffs, but for all the people of New York. When you read through our paperwork, you'll see that that's pretty clear. But anyone signed in as a plaintiff has the opportunity potentially of receiving a monetary, what would they call it, restoration of $50,000. Okay. Also, we you have to fill our paperwork out, so you have to click on, let's see, click here to support, click here. Where is it? Okay, yeah, download the affidavit. We have an affidavit written up. It's a two-pager, and we also have some instructions with some basic information we need from the people. Fill out that paper and get the get the affidavit sworn to in front of a notary, and then get it into the mail. There will be a point in time when we won't be able to add people to this to this filing. So you need to get in now to get the filing going. We're going to be filing soon, we hope. So, you know, get out there and do it. Anyway, read through the paperwork. We also ask that people, give us a donation to National Liberty Alliance from their $50,000. We do plan on winning this case, by the way. But anyway, we ask that people give us 10%, $5,000, but they don't. You don't have to. If you don't sign that, then you're not committing. But if you do sign it, you're committing to donating 10%, which is $5,000 of the $50,000, and then you'd be on your honor to come in and get that National Liberty Alliance. Of course, we don't expect anyone to be held to that until they receive a monetary damages. Okay, let's see what else we got going here. So we need to do more. We need to sue the judiciary. This is one I've been wanting to do for a long time, and we really need to move forward. This is national. We need to sue the federal judiciary. We got a plan kind of to do it. We got to just figure out a few little things here, but we do want to write this paperwork up. We can get the paperwork written up pretty quickly. And then we can file it, but we need the money to file these things again. So we need help, $5 a month or more. Everybody should be able to give $5 a month or more. Give up a cup of coffee and a donut and a roll or something once a month, and that's, you're good, $5 right there. Okay, announcements, Jen.
Okay, I have questions, no particular announcements yet.
Okay.
First question. Does NLA have any specific forms or documents that we can use to rescind tickets and citations?
Okay, we could teach people how to do this themselves by taking the courses. We do have a book that we put together in our website on how to access the court, but the best course to take is the jurisdictionary course. You can click on the button on the right-hand side of our website and take that jurisdictionary court. They'll teach you everything you need to know, how to write papers, how causes of actions, what a summons is, and all the required documents you need in order to file. They give you the whole process and procedure of filing your papers and even giving you some instructions and an education on how to write a paper, what's necessary information to put in there, how it's structured. But that's joined together with really understanding common law. So anybody taking our civics course will get a common law introduction and also education there, because it's quite a long course. It's 120 hours and of audio and video in our civics course. So you get the other side of our education there in the common law. And then we can clean things up by people coming and asking questions here on our Monday night program, and we can give you a little more, you know, tightening up between what you learn from jurisdiction dictionary and what you learn from the common law from Bill Thornton and other sources. And but as far as forms and kind of preset things that you can file with the court and so on and so forth, I'd love to do that. We could do that, but we'd be putting ourselves in jeopardy if we did that. a lot of people in my position, they've come and got them and put them in jail for trying to do something, you know, with the IRS, trying to tell people how to get in trouble with the IRS. And so they come to get you for teaching things. I don't know. I forget what they call them. But that's a problem. And so they go after the people that are teaching these things. And that's why we haven't really put those things out. Okay, we do give, of course, access to the court, access, how to get court access. We give instructions there. And again, this is a regular course. The only course that we support that costs money, which I believe is $249 a month, I mean $249 to get into, if I recall, and I should go look that up. Gerard or someone, can you go see what the cost
is? Yeah, it's $250, John.
$250, okay. So it's $250 for that course. Now, we didn't write that course. We didn't put that course together. That was done by a lawyer. I think he's out of Florida. And it's a very good course. I mean, the guy seems like a really good guy, but he's stuck in the statutory process. You know, that's where he was trained, so it's hard to take that out of him. But he gives you all the necessary information you need to file the papers. Everyone should take that jurisdictionary course. Everyone, whether you're going into court now or not, you should be prepared and able to defend yourself in court. Our Constitution does not guarantee in any way representation by counsel. It does not guarantee that. It guarantees that you have the right to access of counsel. What is it? Let me read exactly what that says. What amendment is that? Is that the Seventh Amendment? No, Fifth Amendment, I think. Let me see. Amendment 5. Or 6, let me see. No, not there. Oh, number 6. For people to have the assistance of counsel for their defense. Think about that. Assistance of counsel for your defense. That's your right. Okay? Not necessarily representation of counsel. Not that you need a lawyer to look at. Nobody knows your case better than you. Now, there is true that some people are very shy or some people can't articulate themselves very well and so on and so forth, and they may have to get someone to come in and kind of help them along and, you know, and you know, make their battle in the case. But the case is really simple. It's all about the facts. You don't need to know anything about the law. Just get in there and talk about the facts and the wrongdoing, what took place, or defend yourself from that wrongdoing or whatever the case may be, and get the assistance of counsel. That's what the Constitution guarantees. But we've got to the point where you can't walk into a court without a counsel, without someone representing you and making your argument for you. You just be quiet and shut up and sit there. You know, I can't tell you, look at when I first started going into the courts and watching people, okay, we were doing this on particularly on the political side of things where challenges were taking place. But in other courts, too, and you walk into the court and there's these people who have a lawyer who sits up. They're called up to the bench and the people sit there. They go up to the bench, too, and they sit there. And they're like just like looking around the courtroom as if nothing's going on, see who's here, and you know, while the lawyer's making the argument, they're not even paying attention. I mean, that's not what justice is all about. That's not what a court of law is supposed to be all about. You need to get up there and make your position. Nobody can defend your position more than you can, better than you can. But they'll teach you that only a crazy man defends himself or runs his own case. You know, you need a lawyer. You got to have someone to represent you. And that's the thing. That's the control. As long as they represent you, they got control over you. They got control over the court. They got control over America. We have to break that and bring it back to where it belongs. So anyway, hopefully I answered the question. Next.
Okay. How can we handle the invitation to appear at the court for citations?
I don't understand. How can they handle the invitation? What?
In other words, you got a citation. They say appear in court on such and such a date. How can they handle that?
Oh, the best way to do is to go into the court and say that you're here to. Oh, goodness, I forget what that process is. It's a. You're really there to test it. You're there to. Gerard, do you remember what that was? We used to use. You're not coming to answer it. You're coming to test the court.
Special appearance.
Special appearance. Okay, I think that is it. A special appearance. You're here by special appearance, and the moment they start talking about anything and all these violations and summonses and stuff, you object to the whole process, and then when you leave the court, there's only one way to beat that. Okay, and actually there's two ways to deal with it, but only one way to beat it. One way you can deal with it, if it's a traffic violation or something like that, pay the $150 or $200 or whatever it is and go home. That's one way to deal with it. Okay, you're not going to win it. You can't argue in that court. You will never win an argument in that court. If there's anything we learned that. You're not going to win an argument in that court. 6 months later, you'll still be coming to that court trying to get out of it. And you're going to get beat up. Okay, there's only one way to win it. And I've said this over and over and over again. Make a federal case out of it. They have no jurisdiction over you. They have no authority over you. They're not giving you no due process. And that's what you sue them for. You sue the judge and the prosecutor for not giving you that due process, violating your right of due process. That's the key. And they don't have the jurisdiction over you. And then you build a case around that. Now, that requires knowledge of how to fill out the papers, file the papers, and defend yourself in that court, which is pretty simple to defend yourself once you have the paperwork filled out. And again, you know, our papers that we have filed in the court, take our New York case. I mean, you can use that New York case, a lot of the stuff in that case, for almost any case. Okay, we've got a lot of information in there. We've got memorandums. Memorandums, you know, we filed, I think 9 memorandums are being filed in the New York case that we're doing here. 9 memorandums, and all of them have its own specialty. You know, what the law is, the common law, defense of the Constitution, defense of the law of the land. It's a memorandum of law Article 3 court, jurisdiction. All of these issues, and it's all done inside the memorandum. So all you have to do is put the conclusion of that memorandum into your paperwork and refer to the memorandum in support of that conclusion, and you move on. Keep everything simple and clean in your paperwork, in your action, okay? This is a pretty big case, so our paperwork on the action is about 22 pages. But most cases don't need 22 pages. You can probably get away with 5, 6, 7 pages. That's about it, and then pile up all of those memorandums. You can change things in those memorandums, add things, do whatever it is that you think you need to do. But there it is a lot of paperwork is already prepared for you in memorandums. You can see the structure. We cover jurisdiction. We cover a series of things in our paperwork. You can see the course that we take through as we go through the process, what we're covering and making our points and building a foundation for our position. And then you get to, you know, really asking questions that they have to answer. But they have to answer everything. And if you make your action a sworn statement, okay, which is what we did, make your action a sworn statement, which means they got to answer every line in that paper. They got to refute every line. And if you're standing on righteousness, they can't refute it. They just can't do it. So, again, people need to get involved, and they need to study. They need to know how to get into the court, how to write the papers, and then defend themselves. Defending liberty and defending righteousness, justice, is a very simple thing to do because ultimately it defends itself. Once you bring the truth to light, it's self-evident. They can't win. But you have to be in an Article 3 court. And once you see that they've pulled you away back into the statutory court, you have to object right away. You have to get a writ of error and correct that judge and overturn his decision through a writ of error. And if necessary, you need to make him a defendant. And that will set the stage for the next judge or that wants to come into
John,
your case.
Hey, John, can I add something here?
Yeah, go ahead.
In these traffic court situations, there was a very good method of getting out of the court in order to do everything you just said without actually pleading and without giving them jurisdiction. And it was, I think it was David Lentz, get out of jail free. And he uses language like what you just said, and he says, I need time for assistance of counsel, and it's in such a way that the judge will never refuse it because he thinks you're going to come back with a lawyer. the way it's worded, but you're not. What you're going to do is you're going to put a paper in, or you're going to put your federal case in or whatever, but it buys you 30, 60, 90 days. I forget how he said to go about it, and it keeps you out.
Usually the judge will ask you, how much time do you think you need?
Right.
30 days.
You know, you tell, a month, 2 months, I don't know. And he it never, they when you phrase it, when you use the wording that he has on there, he says he's never known it to fail. They always give it to you.
Yeah, because they always want you to come in with a lawyer. That's why.
Right.
So once you tell him, I got to get assistance of counsel, yeah.
Right. Doesn't mean you're coming in with a lawyer, but he's going to assume that, and he's going to let you go. So that gives you time to do all this, everything that you just said, so that you're not behind the eight ball with the paperwork. You know what I mean? It gives you time to think and breathe.
Yeah, but remember, an education with confidence. And remember, you have to have confidence with your education. The education without the confidence is no education at all, ultimately, because you have to have that confidence. But education with confidence is probably going to take the average person 6 months. So don't wait to get in trouble to take these courses. Don't wait to get till you get in trouble to try to be able to learn to defend yourself. You need to prepare now. We need to teach our children. We will be going on a campaign at some point in the future, a campaign for educating our children in school at every single level. Get a good, solid civics course in there and a constitutional course. But we can't do that now because we got other things we need to do first. But we will do that. Every child coming out of school should be educated well enough to be able to file their own papers in court and take care of their own case, and maybe have a little bit of assistance of counsel if they need it. And everyone should be able to do that. We should be taught this, but we're not. We don't know. We're ignorant. You know, people think they got to go find a lawyer when they have a legal problem. They think they got to find a priest or a pastor when they have a religious problem or a moral problem. Nothing could be further from the truth. We got direct access to both processes. Go straight to God or go straight to court yourself. You don't need anybody in between you and that place. That's it. All right, anything else, Gerard? Okay, stay muted. Okay, where are we, Jan?
Well, you just led into the next question perfectly. It says, please ask John to explain the simple basics of moving a law or a case for unlawful imprisonment, gun confiscation, moving violations, so forth, from an administrative court to a federal court, keeping in mind the following: acquiring a docket number, filing papers, notice removal, summons, forms, and anything else you feel they will need.
Okay, so that's an entire education right there. I mean,
yes,
that, I'd love to teach that, and I can't right now. Right now, time doesn't give me the ability at the moment anyway. But, well, I could probably find an hour a week to teach something like that. The problem is once I start teaching those things, I become a target, and that's why we've never really taken that step. Numerous times we wanted over the years to do that, to start teaching the people. But we just watch all other people. There's been a lot of people that have gone to jail, got arrested, that were doing those very things because they were becoming successful. They were becoming a danger to the powers that be. So they got targeted, and then they were shut down for a while. And they eventually come out of prison, but you know, we don't want to be there. So it's a big problem. But we give all the tools to learn everything that was just asked in this question. Everything that was asked in that question is available right here at nationallibertyalliance.org. You can get it all. Start with the civics course and the constitutional course, because that's the quickest. You get it done in 6 to 8 hours. You can do that on a Saturday. Then go to the civics course. It's 120-hour-long videos and audios, and you answer some questions. It's a long course, but when you get to the end, I mean, you'll get a good understanding of what's going on, how we got to where we're at, and what you need to do. You'll learn a lot about common law. You're going to learn a lot about American history. You're going to really be overwhelmed with all kinds of wows. Okay, and then from there you move into a higher education. Just go underneath our educational tab and just go crazy on whatever you want. And we've got so much stuff. That's your higher education, reading. Read, read, read. And when you read something, read to understand. Get out your dictionary. Look things up, okay? And don't move from one paragraph to the next until you understand whatever is being told to you or whatever concepts are being conveyed to you in that paragraph. I've come many, many years ago, I came to a conclusion, and before that, education for me was a problem. I'm, an eighth grade dropout, and, I made it through eighth grade. I dropped out of the first year of high school. So, I mean, I never made it past eighth grade. And education was a problem for me because I didn't have the memory. But then I discovered something, and it was a very simple thing, and I believed it. And that's key to this whole thing, is discovering and believing what you're discovering. It's called an epiphany, ultimately. And I come to realize, wait a second, if I understand something, I will never forget it. So anything I read or try to learn, I read with the idea of understanding every word, every sentence, every paragraph, and that has been truth for me. I now, once I understand it, I don't forget it. Sometimes, you speak and you lose your place. You forget a name or a word or a phrase or something. And that happens to all of us. But you know what you're talking about, and you can articulate it. And next thing you know, these things are falling out of your mouth, and you don't begin to wonder, where did this come from? Well, because you understood. Okay, and that's the key to education. And that's how a higher education should be taken. Work through these books and all of these different people that have written all of the fruits of their knowledge that have taken a lifetime to learn, and they put it into a book, and you get to sit down and read it in weeks or a month or maybe even a year to read their books. And you say, understand what they're talking about. It's going to be filed up here, and you'll never forget it. You'll be able to draw it out when you need it. Just trust in that, and that's a fact. But anyway, we have these educations right here, right now. Now, look at the key to this whole thing, to tie it all together, okay, with what we just talked about, to tie this all together and reading our cases. Go up to grand jury and click on our docket page and read through these cases. Copy those pages, cut and paste those paragraphs, get them. My footnotes comes from a file that I named Footnotes that I started 10 years ago or 8 years ago, whatever it was, I don't know. I'd research a word, a meaning of a word or a phrase or something, and I'd go find it through the dictionaries, the legal dictionaries. And I'd cut and paste and get the whatever authorities were on that decision, on that meaning. And I'd put it into a notepad, sometimes a word, but usually a notepad, and I give it a title, okay? And I saved it in a place called Footnotes. And so as I write my papers and I want to emphasize the meaning of what I'm saying, I'll go look up on my footnotes for this word and pop it in and cut and paste it and put it into the footnote area and move to the next step and the next step and the next step. And now you have all these authorities building up on these positions that you're making. They cannot defend themselves from it. The only thing they could do is just lie and make up their own rules and take over the court and destroy you in a courtroom and find against you all the time. That's the only thing they could do. But if you know how to bring them back into the court and make them defendants, that's a whole different story now. And once they realize what you're doing, they're going to want to stop it, and they'll usually kind of negotiate something with you. But anyway, look it. You need to get this education. Jurisdictionary is a must-have. If you're going to go into a courtroom, you want to file a paper, that's where you got to go. I have been to courts. I've asked people for information. They give you these stupid packets which lay out some stuff, but they don't give you the real forms. They don't give you the understanding of how to file a paper, what are the requirements, if this is missing or that's missing, how you got to word your summons. I mean, all those are in forms and in the rules of the court. You'll find them in various places, but nevertheless, there's no layout. You miss one little piece of paper, and they throw you out of court because you didn't get that one little piece of paper in there, You go into court. I remember when I went into court with for the committee man thing, and we knew nothing, trying to figure out the paperwork. But there was a piece of paper we missed to put in, and they claimed that we didn't serve them right or something. I forget what it was. Right? Well, they're here, Obviously, they got it. Well, that's not good enough. It's a technicality. It's a game they play. So you need to know these little things, and that you're going to learn in jurisdictionary. When you make a position in what's called a cause of action, what are you there for? You're making an accusation. They violated you in some way. Well, there's a list the jurisdictionary gives you, for instance, what's called causes of actions. And if you wanted to do something for malice, or you wanted to do something for whatever, you know, kind of a cause of action you can come up with, fraud or whatever, you know, in that cause of action, they'll say, okay, this particular cause of action requires four elements. You must bring up four elements and prove four elements and make certain statements. You have to show the injury, you know, you have to show how they violated you on this or whatever the case may be. Or maybe there's three elements, but they list out the three elements. So when you write your papers, you look at the elements and the cause of action that you're using and you make sure you cover those three elements or two elements or four elements, whatever is required for that particular cause of action. You will lose your case if you don't have all of the elements in there that are required, okay? And remember, causes of actions is a lot more than what you find there, but you get enough of an information and education there to be able to take any cause of action and deal with it and understand what kind of elements are required to make the prove that case, and also the damages have to be there too in a certain criteria, whatever that might be. But anyway, jurisdictionary is the course to learn all those things. Once you take the jurisdictionary course, hopefully you've taken the common law course first, but it doesn't matter. You could take it after. That's inside the civics course. But you can take that after if you have. It doesn't matter. But the thing is at some point you need to correct what you just learned in some areas. We're not under statutes. We're under the law of the land, which brings in common law. That's what we're under. Okay, and there's a difference between the two. You're going to learn statutory processes in jurisdictionary, but your common law will give you the real law, you know, the common law, natural law. And so that works itself out. And of course, we're here to answer questions in that nature. If you brought certain contradictions up between this and that, or what is the best, we can help you there. Once you ask a very specific question, we should be able to give you a very specific answer. And if we can't, we'll find it for the next Monday night meeting and we'll raise it. Or, you know, we also have Brent Winters with us most Mondays, so maybe he'll be able to answer it for us if we can. But, you know, people need to become educated, and they need to have that education. And you're not going to get it without going out and chasing it. So get that jurisdictionary course. And by the way, it costs you $250 no matter how you would where you get to the site. But if you click on our button on our website, then our code is written in there. We get credit for that. We get $50 donation out of that $250 for sending you there. So that helps build us up, too. It's a donation to us by taking the course. But you need that course because that's going to fill in all of the mystery. And believe me, they want it to be a mystery, okay? They don't want the people to know how to come in to get into the courts. They don't want you to know how to fill out the paperwork and prevent yourself by being tossed out. They don't want you to do that because they want lawyers so they can work deals out in the back room. That's what they want. I mean, you could see eyes in the court. I always see, whenever I walk into a courtroom, you know, Gerard and I walked into the courtroom about a month ago or so. We went down on a case we got here in New York down in Dutchess County. And I thought it was kind of funny. I didn't bring this up to Gerard, but I'm sure he experienced the same thing. As we walked in to take the seat, even though they were talking on the front, okay, the judge's eyes, the woman that's the secretary or the clerk to his left or whoever that was, and someone else on the right, you know, their eyes just watched us come through the doors of interest. Who are we? Who are those people? What are they doing here? You know, we wasn't dressed properly. We didn't look properly. And we wasn't on the agenda. There was only a couple of people there. And their curiosity, as soon as they finished talking, they want to know, who are you? And so they ask us, you know, what we're here for. And they were pretty nice, but nevertheless, okay, it rocks their boat, it shakes their tree when the people walk in without a lawyer, okay? And they can usually tell. I mean, we can put on nice fancy clothes and put on ties and suit jackets and carry a briefcase and maybe look like a lawyer, and maybe they won't notice us as much. But I think we're better off going in there, dressed down a little bit, and intimidating them. We're the people, you know, we're the boss. They don't seem to think so, but hopefully as time goes on in that case, we're going to show them we're the boss, you know. And that's really your goal, is to show the judge that you are the boss. This is not his court. This is our court. This is a court of justice. We're here to get justice. We're not here to get the status quo. We're not here to get your opinion. We're not here to get the latest political whatever. We're here for justice. And so over the course of time, hopefully we do, you know, express that purpose over the course of our time as we go into the courts. And we need to object every time we walk into a court because we don't need to be there most of the time. They have all these conferences. I mean, what are they all about? They're all about setting up the status quo. That's what they're all about, getting rid of the evidence they don't want being heard, getting rid of the, you know, things and papers and whatever. It's just a bunch of BS, you know. But anyway, we need to be able to know how to do that. But it all starts out with filling out the papers correctly to get into that court and filling it out and filing them in the fashion that they're looking for it in, that keeps us in the court and not having us thrown out of the court. Because believe me, if your paperwork doesn't have a certain, you know, process to it, and you don't have all the necessary elements of the paperwork that you have to bring together, and you don't know what that is, and you don't have it, believe me, you're going to find yourself outside the court wondering how you got back out, and you can't get back in. And then you got to go and spend another $300 or $400 to get in, which we shouldn't have to spend anything, and that's another subject. But that's what we need to do. We need to know how to get into the courts. And then when you get into the courts, you need to know how to bring the court over to a common law procedure. And you have to be intimidating there. That's where you have to be intimidating. The judge has to be nervous about who you are and what you really know, because he wants to make sure he's protected, because now he doesn't have control over the court no more. You know, when you have lawyers coming in, he's got total control. Come in my back room. This is what you're going to do. This is what you're not going to do. This is how it's going to end up. And I don't want to hear no lip from anyone. Anybody gives me a hard time, I'm going to find you in contempt. I'm going to throw your rear end in jail so quick, you know. And I'm going to take away, you could report you. We'll take away your bar license. And they get all these pressure. They don't even have to say those things. But it's expressed, I think, every time, my opinion. They can't do that to us. We can write a writ of error. Think what would happen to a lawyer who would write a writ of error, okay? Think of what would happen to a lawyer who challenges. I mean, look at that lawyer they tased out there in Oregon because he challenged the paperwork, you know? Lawyers are told to do what they had to do. At some point, when they get out of control, they're going to be brought in the back room and they're going to be straightened out and they're either going to obey or they're going to go to jail or they're going to lose their license or something. You know, it's a horror story, but they can't do that to us. So we can have more power, and we need to exercise that power that we have. All right, hopefully I didn't get too far lost on that, Jan.
Hello.
Jan? Maybe you're still muted.
Jim. My little red button was hit here. Okay. You've already mentioned.
Any other questions, or are we done?
The questions we're finished with. I have one announcement that I forgot.
Okay.
You've already mentioned how we're trying to get you and Gerard onto more radio programs, that sort of thing. So I'd like to ask everybody here, as they spend the day maybe listening to the radio or watching TV in the evening or whatever, think about where you see people, interviews, that sort of thing, talk radio, all that sort of stuff. Are they talking about anything that's pertinent to what we're doing? Is it related to our founding principles? And if so, please either contact me at Jan at National Liberty Alliance or any of the other national coordinators. We'll soon have an email set up for Jim, who will be handling all that. And that'll be jim@nationallibertyalliance.org, but it's not set up yet tonight, I don't think. So in lieu of that, just send it to me, and I'll see that Jim gets it. But we do need your help. Please keep that in mind when you're listening to things, watching things. Anybody doing anything pertinent that kind of fits in with what we're trying to do, please give us a call, send us an email. You can reach me by telephone. It's 814-531-5363. So let us know. Thank you much.
Liberty subjects. I mean, that's the key. You know, people, a radio program, that supports liberty and patriots are listening to. Those are the programs we want to get onto. So anybody who is aware of any of those things locally, whether they're on the AM and FM or whether they're just an internet radio station, whatever, it doesn't matter. Make the contact to get the information, get it to Jim, or actually get it to Jan until we set up Jim's email, like Jan said, and we'll make contact with those programs, those interviews, those radio programs or whatever, to try to get on. We need to get this message out to more people, and we need to do it now. Jan, go ahead.
Okay, Robert had some information, but I don't see him. He had to call in on his cell phone tonight. It's a 503 area code. I haven't been able to find it in the list here for the Western Report. Also,
Jim was going to talk. Well, I don't know if we said enough for what his program is. Jim, do you want to add anything to what we just said?
Sure.
Okay. And then we'll look for Robert meanwhile.
Yeah. You know, today I was looking up some of the Bundy stuff on YouTube, and I came across this video, which is pretty interesting, and I spent a couple of minutes on that. And it was done by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and they were talking about Fourth Amendment violations on your cell phone. So I watched it. It was a five-minute video. But when I got done, I Google searched them, and now they're on my list. I'm going to see if I can get a hold of them, and maybe we can talk, because I looked at their mission statement. So that's the kind of thing that I'm hoping that all the members would come across. I mean, you're just going to stumble across something, just highlight the bar up top, you know, the website or whatever, even the YouTube video, and just send it off. And then we'll make that determination. Maybe they'll want to talk to us, or maybe not. But that's kind of what we're looking for. So.
And you'll send that to probably Jim at nationallibertyalliance.org, but your email is not going to be activated maybe for 24 hours, let's say. So tomorrow, make sure you get a hold of Carl to set you up with an email. If you can't find or get Carl, you know, try to get me.
John.
I think Carl and I are the only one that can set up email, right?
Yeah. I contacted Carl while we were talking, and he just set it up. So you can send things directly to Jim at nationallibertyalliance.org. It's all done.
Boy, that was quick.
All right.
Yep.
Everything should happen like that.
You're right.
You know? Really. And by the way, just to make a note, since he had brought up the Bundy thing and stuff, I think next week we're going to make an announcement for pulling together the people as a grand jury. That's all our members, anybody. And you don't even have to be a member of National Liberty Alliance to come to this grand jury meeting and cast your vote as a grand jury. You just have to. The only requirement is you're one of the people. That's the only requirement. And it doesn't matter where in this country, in this nation that you live. You can come in. So when we call for that, we'll be getting the word out. Hopefully next Monday we'll be announcing that. We're going to be considering indictments for the Lavoie Finnegan assassination. It's going to be first and foremost, okay? We're also going to be considering indictments for the Bundys case and all the players involved in there, the judge and all those people. And also the wildlife preserve, which also the Bundys were involved with and a lot of other people. So indictments for all of that. So these three cases, and then the Hammonds would be a fourth. Okay, so there's kind of four cases or different parts of a case that's one. Because remember, this whole thing is one case. The Lavoie Finnegan, the Bundy Ranch, the wildlife preserves and the Hammond situation, all of that is really one case. So we'd like to be able to handle all of that in one shot. I think we'll be able to do that. What we're going to be doing is identifying the target individuals that need to be considered for indictments, and we will give one or two or three sentences of information about that person, how they played their role in that crime, and then we're going to ask for an indictment. One person at a time as we go through this whole process. We do ask everyone to go out to our webpage, nationallibertyalliance.org. highlight grand jury, click on docket, and go down here and get as much information as you can that you can read and learn about these cases, all the way down on the bottom of the page, right before the video that's on the bottom of the page, you will find grand jury criminal investigation evidence reports. Here you will find a LaVoy Finnegan assassination. You can read the report and watch videos. The forensic report, the FBI forensic report. We got all kinds of stuff here. Now, you may not be able to get through all of this stuff, but you should try to get yourself as familiar as possible. But we will list out the violations and ask for the indictment. Remember, we're not asking for anyone to vote that someone is guilty or anything of anything, just that if they feel that this person has done enough to merit a day in court so that they can be examined by a trial jury who will decide their innocence or guilt. Right underneath the LaVoy Finnegan assassination, you'll see the Bundy Ranch information. We have the trial. Now, the trial transcript is huge. I mean, goodness, it's 4,000 pages or something. But I would suggest to read the Bundy Ranch investigation paper, which is a PDF first, breeze through that. And we've got a whole bunch of videos below that, so you might want to just start viewing that. A lot of people probably have been through a lot of these videos already anyway. Anybody's been paying attention, they've got enough information to be able to make a decision on innocence or guilt. I mean, on indictment or not, and no indictment on these individuals as we lay out their violations. And, of course, the last one is the Wildlife Preserve and the Hammonds thing case. So, again, you know, familiarize yourself as best you can and be ready to come together for a vote for a potential indictment on all of these individuals. I got to believe, let me think real quickly, 10, 20, we're probably going to have about 30 potential people up for indictment. Roughly speaking, okay, maybe 20, maybe 30. And we do want to move quite quickly with this. It's not going to take a long time to go through this. Again, we're going to go one name at a time, read the charges, and people will vote. And we'll go to the next name. Charges, vote, charges, vote, charge. We'll get through it rather quickly, I think. I'd like to say an hour or two at the most, but you're somewhere between an hour to 2 hours. But we hopefully will announce that next Monday, and we will be hitting the mail, letting people be aware of this, of the day and the time to come together for these considered indictments. Jan?
Yeah, I found Robert, and he's unmuted. So, Robert, we're ready for the Western Report. You might have to unmute your cell phone as well.
All right, do you hear me?
Yep, we hear you loud and clear.
Okay, well, we know that this last case was dismissed in Nevada, but now our dear Judge Navarro is considering possibly actually trying the last two people. You know, they had another case to come up after this one, and it includes the last two Bundy boys, and she's actually considering trying the case, even though all this stuff has come up and they had to dismiss this one. And another item is a member of the Committee of Safety in Grant County. That's Sheriff Glenn Palmer's county, has asked that we put one of their commissioners on the list for indictment. And what they're telling me is that he is the one who went to the FBI and pushed them to place the roadblock where they put it. And out of Grant County, because he didn't trust Sheriff Glenn Palmer to make arrests on the Bundys if they were allowed to come into Grant County. And so I'm putting the information together on this person. Also,
Now, you've got an information on this?
Yes. I'm putting it together now.
Okay, yeah, get it to me, and we'll get it up online. And also, we'll go through there to see what kind of charges might be brought against this person. And let me just, before you go any further, let me just make, let's see, there are three people that need to get back to me tomorrow, okay, with their work. Gerard, I think you were working on the Lavoie-Finnegan case, and you need to get back to me with your list and the details of information about each one of those individuals. Jim, I think you were working on the Bundy case, and you need to get back to me. And I think, who was it, William or Gary Will, or who was it that's working on the
Gary Will.
Who was it?
Gary Will.
Gary Will. Okay, so Gary, hopefully you're here. I think you were here earlier. Hopefully you're still here. You need to get back to me with the list of individuals on the Wildlife Preserve case and the Hammond case, and particularly, you know, we'll find a lot of these individuals in the habeas corpuses. So, but there are certain players that names that we need to bring up, FBI agents or things of that fashion. You know, some person from some agency or whatever, whether it be the state police or whatever. But I'd like to get this information from you guys tomorrow or Wednesday at the latest, because I need to work on that to draw up all the necessary paperwork and get it together for the potential indictments that we want to deliver, hopefully, next week, hopefully. So please get that work done, or get back to me and let me know how much more time you need to get it done if you can't get it done for me by tomorrow or the next day. Go ahead. Back to you, Jan.
Okay.
I mean,
you have more, Robert?
Robert.
Yeah, I've got one more item, or a couple. All right. In the roadblock, there was an investigation done on that, and they found one FBI agent that had lied to the investigators, and so they brought him up on charges. And this is being done. This court is in Portland, here in Oregon. And I just found out that the defense attorney is calling for a dismissal based on the fact that the only evidence prosecution has is a ill put together computer program, and that it's worthless, and that the judge should dismiss the case. Well, I see this as a opportunity for prosecution to allow that agent to go free. I think maybe we should consider being a friend of the court and submit our analysis to that prosecutor of the shooting. Give that prosecutor something that he has to go on.
Are they talking about the video analysis that a guy Peter put together that we have?
I don't think they're talking about that. I think they're I'm not sure what the prosecutor has, but the when I look at what the defense attorney says, it looks like it's something totally different. I don't know that that prosecution has that information from Peter.
Yeah,
and maybe we need to make sure he does.
What case is this prosecutor prosecuting? I mean, are you saying that
there's been
an indictment?
This is from Lavoie-Finnegan.
Yeah, so there's been an indictment on this?
Well, one federal agent, one FBI agent was indicted. And he's going through the courts in Portland at the federal courthouse. And I just see the possibility of a little collusion between defense and prosecution.
Well, we can pass all of our information over to him, so I mean, look,
I think if we passed on some information to him, that he'd have no excuse to agree with the defense attorney that he'd have something that he would have to use.
Right. Well, all you know, again, it could be as simple as getting him to come to our website, come to the page on the docket underneath the grand jury, down towards the bottom, and go on the Lavoie Finnegan. We've got it broken up into two ways. We got it into video, and we have it in PDF. And the PDF has lots of videos inside it that are clickable. Okay, so once you download that PDF onto your computer, and you open that video that up, you click on the links, and it'll open up the video for that particular section that's being discussed. And it's very well done. And then, of course, we have, Lavoie Finnegan bearing witness of himself in a, 2.5 to 3 hour video that we put together, slicing together all of his videos that he was reporting up right up until just 2 days before his death, or maybe a day or two before his death. We have him right up to that point, from the beginning to that point where he lays out, ultimately what it is that he's doing, and it really clearly defines the man.
The point Robert's making is this prosecutor is probably colluding with the defense to save the FBI agents.
Probably.
So he's not going to do any research on that. Now, I have something to segue in with this. In the Lavoie shooting, in that tape, they show shooter number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I hesitate to put the names down because I'm not sure. You know how it goes when you make a mistake with a name in a case. So what I was planning on doing is calling it shooter number 1, shooter number 2, as per this Peter's video.
Absolutely.
Right. So I won't put a name because I don't necessarily believe the names that are out there.
Yeah, it's a John or Mary Doe. I got to believe they're all
men. Right. So we'll call it, we'll do better. We'll call them shooter number 1. As according to this tape, they're labeled on the tape. And they know who they are. The government knows who they are.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, so anyway.
And that information you have, Robert, I could use too because
how many bullet holes did Lavoie suffer? Do we know?
You heard a couple of different.
Yeah.
Anywhere from 3 to 6.
Yeah.
Well, it was definitely more than 3, and I think there was even more than 6. But look, we need to identify the shooter by the bullet, too, because I'm sure he was shot by other individuals other than the shooter number 1 through 5.
Well, I think this man that they indicted, I think, is being accused of doing a shooting at the truck as it was, the one who put the bullet hole through the roof.
Well, that's the cop that was in front of it, right?
No, he was up high.
Well, he's up high.
Couldn't we get a copy of the indictment?
Yeah, I wonder why they would indict just one guy with one bullet. I mean, what was that all about?
Well, first of all,
if you can get us a copy of this indictment, that would be very interesting to look at.
Well,
they just wanted a scapegoat to appease the people, I'm sure.
Yeah, and they went over the least innocuous when they said, "Oh, he shot into the truck. Look, it was unprovoked." And it was random.
But
it could have hit anybody.
It also come out that they actually cleared brush and made firing lanes.
Right.
So, to me, that's premeditated murder.
Absolutely.
And so, every officer out there is guilty of murder. Whether he pulled a trigger or they were just there, they were aiding and abetting, and they didn't do anything to stop it.
All right. Anything else, Robert?
No. I will try to get that indictment and everything.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Robert. Anything else, Jen?
Yep.
No, that's everything that I had.
Okay, I'm going to move control of the board over to you, Gerard.
Thank you.
and I'll be in and out. I'm going to take a little break right now, but I'll be in and out, and we'll go from there. But before we move forward to Q&A, is Brent here?
I'm here.
Yep.
Okay, how you doing, Brent?
Oh, I'm all right. Just get my phone fixed so it'll transmit. Go ahead.
Okay, we're going to move over to you then. We're going to move the call over to Brent, Brent Winters. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And my comments here are my own, I like to say, and not, may or may not be the opinion or the position of National Liberty Alliance, but maybe. In either case, they're mine. I get a lot of emails and messages from people because of, I suppose, some of the things I say in public forums, and I got one today. It's a picture of a book, picture of pages from a book that a lady was reading, and I was able to read it. She wanted me to read something. I read it, and I said, that's a good book, and I messaged her back, and I said, I need to read this book. I could tell it was a book I wanted to read because it looked like he was saying things that I hadn't heard before. Some things I'd heard before, but he had a way of saying it that I wanted to make part of my way of saying things. And then I looked at the cover. She sent me that, and I said, oh, I remember this fellow. 25 years ago at the Kemper Convention Center in downtown Kansas City, I met him. And he's pushing 90 years old now. And I remember why I went there. It was a debate. He was debating a left-wing Jewish lawyer from New York City. He himself is a Mexican law professor. And it was shocking and refreshing to listen to him talk, a Mexican law professor from the University of Texas at that time. I think he still teaches there even at his old age. And older age, I should say. He's still going strong, apparently. But the thing I remember him saying, I didn't remember his name, but I've quoted him often under the idea that he who never quotes is never quoted. I found that to be true. And that, by the way, is a quote from a very well-known man at one time. I like to quote that quote. He who never quotes is never quoted. Then I like to quote other people, and I find that sometimes people quote me, and then people remember what they have said, and they quote them. So start quoting people. Quote people you admire, and always give good credit for those people, and it will enhance their message, and it will enhance your message, too. People will quote you. Well, what he said was this, and I somehow stuck in my head when it happened, and I've never forgotten it. He said that the question in the debate in which he was engaged was not whether government was competent to do any particular thing, and the debate was about busing, by the way. He said the question is not, he told the other fellow, you've got it all wrong. You don't ask the right question, you don't get the right answer. If you don't ask the right question, there's no way you can get the right answer. But if you ask the right question, he said, you might get the right answer. You stand a fair shot at it. By the way, that's what Jesus Christ said to the lawyer in Luke chapter 10, when the lawyer, seeking to justify himself, said, who is my neighbor? And Jesus Christ told the story about the Samaritan. He got to the end, and it was abundantly apparent by what he said that he was telling this lawyer, you're asking the wrong question. You ought to know enough to ask the right question. You'll never get the right answer asking the wrong question. Well, he said the question is not whether government is competent to do anything, or this particular thing. And then he said the question we must ask is government competent to do anything? And the answer, he said, was a resounding no. Well, then one would ask, well, why do we allow government to do anything? Well, if we're smart, we won't allow government to do much. There are some things that only government can do. We can't do. We could, maybe, but if we did it, we'd become government. You know, if we organized the militia of the several states without the assistance or the authority of the governor or the president, but went off to fight a war, by that time, we're the powers that be. We're the government ourselves. Well, so what we say is there are some things only government can do, and if you end up doing it, you are the government. And one of those things, by the way, is national defense. The Constitution of the United States gives government, because the authority was given government, it is something that government must do, but I don't say for a second that government fights wars well. I know better. Why? Well, I've been in places where all those crazy things have been tried to have been done. And I've also read history of war, and I have discovered, reading history, that governments aren't competent to do anything, and I've discovered that governments aren't competent even to do that, although it is the one thing that our common law recognizes through the centuries. God recognizes also in a first principled way that the combined power of a country, of a people, has authority from him to wage war in certain circumstances. Well, so government's not competent to do anything. I believe that law professor was right down there at University of Texas. Government's not competent to do anything, but government, there's some things only government can do. Number one, war. Yep, that's what government should be doing. And number two, of course, they should be doing it according to due process, according to the courses of our common law. Number two, government is to provide justice. What does that mean? Well, government is to provide justice, like government provides post roads and post offices. We've gone too far. You know, there's no place in our Constitution. I learned this in high school, studying for the Constitution test so I could get out of high school. There's no place in our Constitution that empowers government to carry letters for money. No place. And for the post office to do this is ultra vires. It's outside the powers of the federal government. And I'm not the first one to say that. That's been said since the days of the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states. And the reason government started carrying letters in mass way back then and forbidding, by the way, anybody else to do it, is because they wanted to, and they've done it up until now and are still doing it. They wanted to keep track of who was communicating with who and control everyone. And that's why there's a post office traditionally in America in every little teeny tiny place in America, including towns, villages that aren't even incorporated by villages. I know there are post offices here in places where there's just a settlement. There's a post office. Of course, the internet has changed that some, and post offices are waning, they're out of money, and they even closed some of them. Why? Well, they can check up on you on the internet now anyway. They know everything about you. Just go to Facebook, and find out who your friends are and who you communicate with, what your political point of view is, etc., etc., ad infinitum ad nauseum. Post offices, though, were the reason for it. But the point I'm making is the government's gone beyond its powers with the post offices. And it's also gone beyond its powers in a good many other places. But justice is one of the things. Justice, what does that mean? That means just like the government is supposed to, according to the Constitution, provide post offices, the buildings, and post roads, and then contract the services if they have to, but they are to provide the buildings and the roads so the mail will go. And also, government is to provide justice. What does that mean? Same principle. Government is to provide the buildings, the places where we can go to court, and the machinery of government. William Blackstone said that the glory and the distinct advantage of Anglo-Saxon common law, and when he says Anglo-Saxon common law, he doesn't mean the common law after the year 1066 when the Normans invaded England and brought the imprint of Rome with them. No. He meant the glory of Anglo-Saxon law was that it brought justice to the door of every cottage. What did he mean? He didn't mean he brought the sheriff to the door of every cottage. That wasn't what he was talking about there in that volume. He was talking about bringing, making available a forum, a place where you could go and drag your neighbor into court if you had to, if you wronged you. In old Anglo-Saxon England, there was a courthouse, a place where you could hold court, provided by the village manor court and the little tiny township. They called them hundreds. We call them townships. Same thing. They've come to America. Every township, not every county had a court, no. They called them shires before the Normans got there. Not every shire had a court. Not every county. Every township had a court, and even sometimes more than to a smaller juridical entity than that. Justice was available. You didn't have to travel to the county seat, which was a long trek in those days, but every approximately 100 families, and sometimes less than that, had a court they could access with a judge. That's what Blackstone meant when he said the glory and the advantage of Anglo-Saxon common law was it brought justice, a courthouse, a forum, a place to meet, to impanel the jury, to the door of every cottage. What did he mean when he said cottage? Well, he meant to the door of every humble home. And in those days, about, according to the census, when William the Conqueror got there in 1066, he compiled his Doomsday Book, and it was 38C260. It was 70% of the people were the equivalent of what they called cottiers. The cottier, that's a person that lives in a cottage and has 5 acres or less to till. That was the lowest rung of freemen, cottiers and villeins. That was low. But they all had little cottages and little buildings they and their families lived in, little dwellings. And every man in his little cottage, according to the common law, was king in his own cottage. And government may not be competent to even do that, but it is the one thing that government is supposed to do according to our Constitution of the United States, which is a brief of common law government and true throughout the country. One thing about judges, are judges, can you arrest a judge? I got a call, I was on the radio, got a call from a fellow in Georgia. He said he was calling from Georgia, and he told me that if the judge didn't rule according to the law in his case, he was going to arrest the judge on the spot. I said, why do you want to do it on the spot? He said, well, it's a citizen's arrest. I've got to do it while he's committing the felony. I said, okay. Well, you know what's going to happen if you do that, says I. He said, what? I said, well, the bailiff's going to tackle you, and you might bust your head or knock out your teeth as you go down, which sometimes can happen if you hit the edge of a table or something. He's going to tackle you, and then you're going to get handcuffed. I mean, and generally speaking, I thought this is what would happen. And then they're going to drag you off to court or drag you off to jail, and it's just going to get ugly. And he said, well, I have authority to do that as a citizen. I said, yes, you have authority to do a citizen's arrest. And yes, you're right. A citizen can only arrest a person for a felony, generally speaking, a common law felony and not a misdemeanor. That's true in every state. But he has to catch him. He has to do it either in the act of committing the felony or right at the felony, before or after, generally in every state, give or take. But there's one thing that mitigates that. And he said, what's that? And under no circumstances can you ever, in a common law country like ours or a common law state like Georgia, you can't arrest a judge while he's sitting on the bench. It's against the law. Always has been. For centuries. Still is. You can arrest him afterwards, but then in this case, by the time he gets off the bench, you can't do a citizen's arrest lawfully because he's already committed, if you thought he committed a felony. But then again, is it possible for a judge to commit a felony by ruling against the law like this, I don't know what you call this, person out here on the bench in this Bundy case? I don't know what that is. And that one up in Oregon, allowing marshals to come in your courtroom, and like John says, it's not their courtroom. Well, yeah, I see what John's saying. It's not, but at the same time, they have authority there to stop U.S. Marshals and other cowboys from tasing people that they're asking legitimate questions, especially officers of the court, like lawyers. But that whoever that judge was didn't. It's funny, they take a lot of, they exercise a lot of power until it's against the people they want to teach a lesson because they don't like the way they act, like lawyers defending people you don't like. But at any rate, can you arrest a judge before or after? No. And when can you arrest a judge? What can we do to these judges? How can we get judges off the bench that are doing unlawful things like we're seeing out there? It's just, it's egregious. It's loathsome. I don't even like it anymore. I don't even want to hear about it. It's crazy what's going on. Well, of course, common law. Can you sue a judge? Well, you can sue a judge if the judge leaves the judicial role, acts outside the scope of the judicial authority. And that judicial authority, and there's plenty of cases on it, you can go read them, is very, very wide. Now, I did read a case not too long ago about a gal. She worked for a judge and got fired. And she sued the judge. Yeah, that's what it was. Worked for the judge, got fired, and sued the judge. And what was the basis of the suit? I think it was some kind of racial discrimination. And the court had to decide, because the judge said, you can't sue me, I'm a judge. And the court had to decide whether or not the judge, in firing this person, acted outside of the judge's judicial role. In other words, is hiring and firing employees part of the judicial function? And the court in that case said, no, it's not. Have at the judge. The case stands. Clean them if you have to or want to. Do whatever you can get away with. I'm exaggerating a little, but that was what the court said. Had to go up on appeal. So we know, and generally speaking, I think this is true, there is a limit to the judicial role. But then I read another case, and forgive me for those of you that listen to me talk once in a while, I may have pulled this on these presentations. This case demonstrates how broad the judicial role is. Judge in Chicago, Illinois, well, right there, we're talking Chicago, we're talking about Obamaville, we're talking about a man who's the mayor, who is a citizen of Israel. His father's the chief rabbi over there, and he doesn't know whether he wants to be an American or not. That's the mayor of the place, and he belongs to last I heard, he belongs to some kind of a bathhouse where all sodomites gather. Obama belongs to the same bathhouse. His name is Emmanuel. So the city is on the skids. You know, they murder people. It's just part of the scenery to murder people up there by the dozen and a half dozen every day. I'm exaggerating a little to make the point, but not much. But in that city, there was a judge. And the judge owned some apartment buildings. And there was a fellow in one of the apartment buildings he owned who wouldn't pay his rent. So the judge tried to go through the judicial system to get him out of the apartment. And he did, and the fellow then came back. He knew how to get in, and he had his sleeping bag, and he just never left. So the judge was down checking on his apartment buildings, and he opens the door of this apartment, and here this fellow is that he had had evicted. Well, that really made him mad. He blew a proverbial head gasket. And he reached in his back pocket and pulled out what wise people carry in Chicago, namely a pistol. He had a pistol on him. He pulled out the pistol, made the fella get down on the floor on his belly, held the pistol to his head while he sat on top of him, and used his judicial authority to hold court. And he declared him in violation of a court order and fined him, and then I think he got his wallet out, took some money out of it to deposit with the court or something like that. And the case went up to the Seventh Circuit. And the question was, did he leave, because this fellow tried to sue him. The question was, did he leave his judicial role? And the answer that the Seventh Federal Circuit, mind you, this was a state judge, so it had to wind its way through the system, but the Federal Circuit, and I can't remember whether it was Easterbrook, Brooke, or Posner, they thought it was amusing. Pretty good writers, both of them. I don't know that they're good guys, but they're good writers, fun to read. But they said this. That's crazy. They said, that guy's crazy. And they said that that judge is liable criminally if somebody prosecuted him. Of course, they were hastened to add, like judges usually do, that's not my job. I'm just the judge. I don't have the power of prosecution. But somebody ought to prosecute him for brandishing a weapon unlawfully and a whole bunch of stuff. But they concluded that him holding court, whatever else he may have done that ought to throw him in jail, land him in jail for 20 years, if he was not prosecuted, we have no jurisdiction to deal with that question. The only question before us is, did he act outside of his judicial role? And the answer was no, he didn't. The truth is, the fellow was in violation of a court order, and did the judge have the power to grab him and take the money away from him at the point of a pistol? Now, that was probably outside the judicial role. I think they kind of said that. But as far as what he did, it wasn't outside the judicial role. And I just tell those stories to show you how bizarre things really get. The stuff never hits the newspapers for some reason, but it's all out there. Now, that's enough to make a fellow's blood boil, I know. And some of you are probably saying, God, if I ever got a man like that in a dark alley, that he'd wish that he'd never been born. Well, you can think that. But we deal with two things when we deal with law and courts and government. We deal with the law and courts and government. Then we deal with reality, and the reality is that that's what the courts say. Now, I understand the reasoning in that case, and he ought to be prosecuted. And the sad thing is that nobody prosecuted that judge for the way, W-A-Y, the method, the manner, the process that he used. As a matter of fact, it was a violation of, in my humble opinion, a violation of separation of powers. That judge is a judge. When he also wanted to become the executive branch and execute the law, then he becomes the executor of the law, and that's outside of his judicial role, you see. And I believe that there's something in the law that ought to be. But at any rate, the point I'm making is, when I say these things, is that the judges, it's hard to sue a judge for leaving his judicial role. Although I have seen cases, I've been in cases where I'm convinced a case could be had and it had a good chance of sticking. Well, I wanted to mention those things because they came up and they were important. I'm glancing at some of the things that I jotted down. Oh, I wanted to point out that I just got a call from a lady, and she has presentations of yours truly, 30 hours and 15-minute clips, 30 hours, blow by blow, clause by clause, audio commentary on Magna Carta. Magna Carta. And they had a fellow contact me from out in Montana. He said he wanted me to write an article about Magna Carta, and he wanted me to do an audio series because of the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. And my circumstances right at that time, that was a couple of years ago, I was unstable. I was here, there, and yonder. And I made a point, though, every day of sitting down early in the morning, and for 15 minutes, I made a recording. I just shot from the hip, just looked at Magna Carta, got it out, and started talking and tried to apply it, show how the principles of it apply now. That was my idea. I wanted to do that. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. This fellow said he wanted me to do it. I said, well, I want to do it too, so I did it. And now they're available. Well, this lady contacted me today, and she has a copy of it on CD, and she said, I want to talk to you about this, get your permission, but I want to get this in print, and so she's going to help me do that, and then I'm going to edit it. A lot of times what you say on audio doesn't come out right in print until you put it in written form and play with it a little bit, but I want to get it in print, and I want to make it available, but the audio is still available, and I wanted to mention that in case people are interested. It's one of my ambitions in life to cut through the stupidity, and when I say stupid, I mean I use that word in its technical sense, thick and slow, without any reason to be thick and slow. It's just downright stupid to say that Magna Carta is old and no longer in force. No, Magna Carta is in force. Every principle that I see in Magna Carta is applicable right now, here, today. Not just a couple. You know, people say, well, there are a couple things. The Englishmen say this. They say there are two parts of Magna Carta still in force, a trial by jury and justice delayed is justice denied. I mean, give me a break. Are you folks smoking crack? Well, you're not thinking. Go back and read that thing and tell me it doesn't apply. Of course it applies. If you can't see the principle, your brain is not in gear. Get your brain in gear. I know you're smart. Speaking of smart people, John said a while ago, and he'd said this before, said he got through the eighth grade, but he quit the first year of high school. Well, I was taught to read by a man that got through the eighth grade, and that was my father. And I'm thinking of John. John, probably fortunate he didn't go to any more school, because there's nothing more dangerous in this world than miseducation. Dressed up like education. You know, education can be right or it can be wrong. Education is not the answer. Most education teaches the wrong thing, the wrong bent, the wrong inclination. And if you're being educated by government, you're going to get government's twist on everything. Now, educational institutions don't exist but for one reason. All of them, whether Christian institutions, Islamic institutions, government institutions, they all exist for the same fundamental reason. To put a particular spin, a particular interpretation on the same facts that everybody's teaching. There is no other reason for education. I used to say to my children, I'm not worried so much about you reading and writing. I mean, if you don't read and write, that's not the worst thing that could ever happen. I just don't want you miseducated. If you're rightly educated, but you don't know how to read and write, you'll get along. The important thing in life is hearing, more important than reading. Listening is more important than reading. I've known people all my life, different people that couldn't read and write. Had an Uncle Lester, never did learn how to read and write. He did pretty darn well for himself, lived decently, had a nice home. He was a home builder for a long time, as a matter of fact. He could figure out numbers pretty good. It's just the reading he couldn't do. But it wasn't because he wasn't smart. It was because he never had an opportunity to learn. His father didn't even send him to school. My great-great-granddad, I don't know if he knew how to read and write at all. Didn't think it was important, maybe. I don't know. But reading and writing is important. Don't misunderstand me. And by the way, John said this too. He said, I forget how he put it. He said read carefully or read for reception, but he said read and try to understand what you're reading. I want to make mention of this. I read this book years ago. I read a book, and the name of the book, written back in the 50s, I think, the name of the book was How to Read a Book, written by a professor from the University of Chicago. And the University of Chicago was kind of new then. It's a highfalutin school, but it was funded by some awful wealthy people, and it became very prestigious very quick. I think it was founded in the 1930s. But the fellow's name that wrote the book was Mortimer Adler. Mortimer Adler wrote a book called How to Read a Book. But I couldn't tell you what he said in the book. You wouldn't have to read the book. I'll just tell you what he said, and you'll get it. I've done it a lot, and I know lawyers that advocate this method, how to read a book. Well, you read a book. The way you ought to read a book is the way you read anything, the way you read a statute, the way you read a letter, the way you read the Bible, the way you read anything you read, newspaper. If you really want to understand it, you really think it's important, here's a good way to do it. You read through it just quickly and relaxed. Just read through it. Just enjoy it. Get a feel for it. And then, when you're done, you go back. Let's say you're reading the Constitution, reading the Declaration. And you don't have to read the whole thing in one sitting. Just read the part you want to read, maybe just one paragraph. Read it. And then read it again. This time, read it. For the first time, you just read it to get a flow of the thing, a feeling for the thing. Next time you read it to understand it, to put it together, see how the sentences and the facts, get the facts. And then the third time you read it, you try to read it for application. Wait a minute, what is he saying here? Is this anything I can use? Just three times, and when you do that, as you continue to do it, you'll get good at it, and you'll get your own twist to doing that. Reading's important. I don't want to say it's not, but it's not as important as listening. There are only four liberal arts. People talk about, this liberal arts. I teach at a liberal arts college. You go to a liberal arts college, ask the professor or one of them there, well, what are the liberal arts? The answers will be all over the board. I've done this. That's how I know. I ask. When I see a professor from a liberal arts college, I just very kindly ask him, I want to know what he says, of course. I know what I think. But I say, well, what are the liberal arts? You wouldn't believe the answers you get. And they're most of them all wrong. The liberal arts are only four, never have been more than four, never will be. They've been around forever. Nobody really recognized them in a well-known way until a man who lived on the north side of Africa at a town, like a Roman town called Hippo. Hippo means river in Greek. They named it after a river and they called it Hippo. His name, very famous fellow now, his name was Augustine. Roman Catholics call him Augustine. The Protestants call him Augustine. The Protestants follow his doctrine. The Roman Catholics sainted him and threw his doctrine out and accepted his enemy's doctrine, Pelagius. Fascinating story about the Pelagian controversy. But Augustine said that there are four liberal arts. He was just recognizing this. He didn't make this up. He's not the one that made it so. It's just the way it is. He said, you know, when I think about it, he said, I can understand most of what I hear. I can say most of what I think. I can write most of what I think. And he said, I can understand most of what I read. Well, there are four things there, reading, writing, listening, speaking. Kind of sounds like reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's pretty close, as a matter of fact. But reading, writing, listening, and speaking. Those four things, those and no others, those and no more. And people say, well, what about thinking? Listen. And Augustine told this too. He said, if you can read and write, listen and speak, your brain will naturally gear up and start going. You can't stop it. Horses are born to run, birds are born to fly, beasts of prey are born to ferocity, and hounds are born to hunt. And men are born to think. This is something you have to learn. All this talk about teaching people how to think is the distraction of the evil empire and the useful idiots of it. Men do know how to think. Your neck's in the noose. Your life, liberty, or property is on the balance. Your brain will start working. No matter who you are, no matter what you look like, no matter how much school you have been to or haven't been to, no matter how miseducated you are, and this is what I perceive to be what National Liberty Alliance is trying to say, unless folk like you and me and people who don't hold the levers of power, unless their minds are engaged, unless they understand and discern right from wrong, male from female, the evil empire from the kingdom of God, the law of the land from the law of the city, due process from decrees, unless all those distinctions are being made first nature among a critical mass of Americans, it's over. And I agree. And why do I agree? Because I read history. And I know that's what happens when it's over, and you'll find, you read history, you find that the more, and this is odd, why it's true, I'm not sure, but the more men lose their freedoms. And one fellow said, let me put it this way, why is it that when men want to proclaim their liberty the loudest, they do nothing more than rattle the chains of their slavery and talk about how free they are, when the truth is they've been slowly boiled like the frog, the chains have been put on them, and they rattle their chains like the Jews of Jesus Christ's day. We are free. We have never been enslaved to any man, they said to him. And at that very moment, they were enslaved to the Romans. They've been enslaved to the Egyptians. They've been enslaved to all sorts of people. The Babylonians had taken them into slavery. And then just keep saying it. Keep saying it because it makes you feel good. But it's not true. What makes people free? It isn't saying I'm free. That's not what makes you free. What makes you free is knowing the law, the true law, of the true lawgiver, the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is, It comes in two volumes, by the way. The Laws of Nature, Unwritten in the Nature of Things. I'm quoting our Declaration of 76. The Laws of Nature, Unwritten in the Nature of Things. And the Laws of Nature's God, Lex Scripta, written in the Bible. That was the opinion of William Blackstone, the author of the Commentaries on the Laws of England, Commentaries on the Common Law that were so influential in our own country. That also is the statement of John Locke, the Laws of Nature and the Laws of Nature's God. That phrase is from his understanding of reality. He was a student of John Owen, the great Puritan. John Locke's phrases are the guts of our Declaration of Independence, because Tom Jefferson said he was one of the three greatest men that ever lived. The Laws of Nature, Unwritten, Lex non scripta, and the Nature of Things, the Laws of Nature and God, written in the Bible. Now, I've been 2 weeks, and I have neglected to say anything about, and I try to discipline myself to following a plan when I talk. And the reason I try to do that is, and I didn't do it the last 2 weeks, I talked about the things I've been talking about. And I'm going to read one paragraph, lest I not progress through our Declaration of 76. The reason I like to keep to a plan is so that I don't hobby horse. You know, people do hobby horse. All of us do it at different times if we keep talking it up. But if I stick to a written text and try to progress through it, it helps keep me from hobby horsing. Let me read paragraph 19 of our Declaration of 76. It says that we're filing this common law complaint with the world, the court, before the world. This is our declaration of shifting dependence. It says we're upset. Our complaint is that King George III has imposed taxes on us without our consent. Our common law has always forbidden levying of taxes without legislative advice and consent. That phrase, advice and consent, is ancient in our common law. I have a copy of a document written about the year, let me think when it would have had to have been, because King Alfred the Great's signature is on it, but he was just a boy. But because they knew he would probably be king, they wanted him to sign this document. It was a deed for land. That would have been about the year 860. Almost, well, that's 1,200 years ago almost. Well, in that document, indeed, for a hide of land, which is about the amount of land that you could plow with a team of oxen in a day, that was a hide, and the King of England, King Alfred's father, wanted to sell a hide of land and 10 wagon loads of wood, says so right on the document. But in order for the king, kings were limited in those days, as executives ought to be today at common law. And by law, they are in America, the presidents and the governors, but we're finding ways to let them circumvent that. But the kingship was limited, and even if he wanted to sell his own land and 10 wagon loads of wood, he had to have the, watch these words, the advice and consent of the Wittenagemot, which is the elders assembled, And every one of them signed that deed with their advice, and then their signing was their consent for him to sell his own land. Now, not everybody had to have the consent of the elders to do what he wanted to do, but the king, they rode herd on him pretty hard. They didn't want him to do anything which they did not approve. And that word advice and consent has come down to us, and without advice and consent, our advice and consent, however it has come to him, or to the legislative branch, by due process, they're not to tax us without it. Now, common law requires government to follow a certain process in order to tax a people. And this course of process is due and owing from government. And it includes, that's called due process, in this case, it includes obtaining the taxpayer's consent. Now, our Constitution says that it is the supreme law of the land. This Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, Article 6. I know people, good folk, right-headed folk in many respects, and they say that the Constitution of the United States is blasphemous because it attempts to usurp the very standards of God, the law written, by claiming that it is the supreme law of the land. And I even have a book, a big book, written by a fellow who studies very hard, who wrote a book about it, and that was his position. That's what he tries to show. And our Constitution of the United States is called the supreme law of the land. That's what our founders called it, because that phrase they lifted from Magna Carta. The Latin is lex terra, and that means law of the land or land law. And they lifted it out and put it in our Constitution because in the day of Magna Carta, that phrase, law of the land, was their phrase, the Anglo-Saxons and the Anglo-Danes' phrase for due process. Why they called it due process, why they used that, they didn't say due process, they said law of the land. Because it was such a part of who they were, it made them so different than everybody else in the world, and still makes us different. In what way? Well, we stress in America, because we're a common law country, it's not important this or that law, what's to be done, W-H-A-T, but how it is to be done. We are process-oriented. We are not result-oriented in a common law country. We shouldn't be. That's our common law. In other words, the ends does not justify the means. No, the means justifies the ends in our country. And so the law of the land is a reaffirmation of that. And our Constitution of the United States is fundamentally, above all things, not as much. It does not stress, I lost my mic, it does not stress what is to be done. It stresses how it is to be done. It's the how that is important. How are laws to be taxed? How are to we impeach judges? How are we to elect our senators? The how questions, the big question at common law, always the big question at common law. John mentioned a while ago, so many things came up that were important to our common law. Serving process on the other fellow, that's fundamental. You're bringing him to court, you've got to give him notice. And a meaningful opportunity to respond. And you have to have the same thing. And if that doesn't happen, we don't ratify the result. By the way, God won't ratify it either. It's the process that's important. And that phrase, law of the land, is the supreme process, the supreme process. And that's not blasphemous. That's what God wants. You want to know what God wants? He sets forth some first principles, 10 of them. About lying, stealing, committing adultery. Lie, steal, covet. Lie, steal, commit adultery. And murdering your neighbor. You don't want to murder your neighbor. No, that's unloving. That's not a loving thing to do. Murder is, it's wrong. Are we teaching our children that? Do they go to public school and learn the Ten Commandments? Do they learn the fundamental law, the fundamental laws that will bring death to them, possibly, get them executed? There's nothing more important in life than learning fundamental principles of law. Why do I say that? Because God said that. He requires it of men that they learn some fundamental things. Do not covet, lie, steal, commit adultery, or murder your neighbor. How can anybody rightfully, sensibly argue that those things aren't what we should be teaching every child? That was the last 5 of the Ten Commandments in reverse order. I learned them backwards through a quirk of circumstances. But those are fundamental. We need to learn those. And back to the taxation, this is where I leave off. The Supreme Court, Magna Carta, I talked about that. Due process is our Constitution requires for a government's exercise of taxing powers. In other words, in order to tax, if you remember, the Senate can introduce tax legislation according to our Constitution. You see, that's how it's to be done. H-O-W, that's the process we got to follow. And that significantly, the most recent, this Obama health care baloney they put up, that bill was ruled to be a tax legislation by the Supreme Court of the United States. But then somebody came back and said, wait a minute, it's taxes. The Constitution says it can't be initiated. It cannot begin in the Senate. It has to begin in the House of Representatives. And lo and behold, it began in the Senate. That means none of it is valid. None of it is law. It's all a ruse, a hoax. Why? because they didn't follow due process. They didn't do it the right way. They didn't follow the rules. They didn't turn the square corners. That's unlawful, friends, neighbors, and relatives. At what point do we say, wait a minute, there's a process here that the government's supposed to follow. Our Constitution is about the process government is supposed to follow, not the process we're supposed to follow. And it's up to us to hold them to it. Is that a tax? No. The Obama bill is void, dead on arrival. You say, well, we've got to wait for the courts. Well, maybe we do, maybe we don't. I hope it goes to the court. And if it goes to the court, it's always part of decency of a freeman to wait till it goes to the courts before you start raising too much cane and not paying taxes. But I make the point here. It's obviously it didn't follow due process, so not a good result. Well, King George III, using Parliament, taxed the colonies while barring them from forming local legislatures to give or withhold consent to taxation from sending representatives to Parliament in England to debate and cast a vote to give or withhold consent. So to sum up, ownership of property such as money, you see, our common law and our Constitution repeats this, private property is not to be taken from anybody without due process of law, and the money is property. Therefore, the government is not allowed to take money through taxation unless it follows due process of law in doing so. It has not done so with the Obamacare bill. So they didn't follow due process. They're not entitled to take your tax money for that, Obamacare. I'm just using that as an example. And so I've heard that there are cases going through the system on that point. Taxation is government's taking the property. Consequently, common law demands that government in laying and collecting taxes follow the law of the land, due process, in getting constitutional consent. John or Gerard, thank you very much. Remember, the only remedy for lawlessness, the lawlessness you see swirling about you, the only remedy is true law. Back to you.
Okay, thank you, Brett.
Thanks, Gerard.
Okay, we're going to open up the queue. Maybe somebody's got questions for Brent or myself or whatever. So I'm going to go ahead and hit the first question here. Let's see. And that's Eric.
You may now ask your question.
Okay, thank you. I got in a little late. I didn't think I'd be first, but okay. So here's a question I have for, you know, you and Brent, and I didn't really want to ask this question, but I really want to ask this question because Brent just brought it up, something that made me think of this question. But I know I don't possess the patience and temperance and tolerance and humility of Brent and John, who've been studying the Bible for 30, 35 years, but I want to ask this question. So Brent was saying, you know, we need to bring back the Ten Commandments, which I agree, of course, completely. But let me tell you what they're going to say. They're going to say, why don't you, instead of that, the people that are in power and such, and people that have been brainwashed, which is the great majority of us, they're going to say, well, why don't you bring in something from FDR's wife or Lady Bird Johnson about civil rights? This way, if you bring in something about civil rights, and of course this was meant to usurp meant to usurp Christian principle in the first place, is my belief. Why don't you bring in something about civil rights? Because that won't offend non-Christians here in America. Because when people come here, maybe we should assimilate to them as opposed to them assimilating to us. So my question is, based upon that, is if. And again, I don't have the patience and temperance and tolerance and humility y'all have, but when does it become too late, or when might it be too late for us to act, you know, i.e. Patrick Henry time, as I refer to it. In other words, if after trying to form our committees of safety and to get anyone to listen across the country that will listen, when does it become too late for us to act? When are we too beaten down for us to be able to do something? And should we not then take up our arms and be prepared to fight not just our enemy, but those who side with our enemies, such as what might have been referred to as loyalists? And again, I know this is impatient and this lacks the virtue of patience, but I'm just asking for your opinion on this. I'm not saying it's time to pick up our arms, but if we follow due process by trying to form committees of safety, when do we see that it's might be too late to act, if you see what I'm saying? That's my question, and thank you.
Well, I'm sure Brent has a good answer for that, but I'm going to give you my opinion for myself. And what that is that it's never too late, first of all. We are at war now, and we're fighting a battle of the pen, so everybody should be fighting that battle. I say right now, give me liberty or give me death. That's how I feel. But I don't want to die, but, you know, so I take my opportunity now to fight on paper. Now, there was a situation over here in Oregon where they formed a committee of safety, which got everybody worried, because and with the Bundys, where the people got together and amassed in order to stop the actual action of government that was blatantly taking their freedom, life, liberty, and property. Look at when you carry a gun, there's some certain rules about when you can shoot, and that's when somebody's in the act of committing a felony. There's no big question in my mind. It's just that, you know, do you want to start, you know, is it time to start a war? And is it going to be a localized war, or what is it? You know, our forefathers, they lit brush fires in the minds of men. And you know, you have no business starting a revolution. If you can't win a war, you have no business starting it. So how do you start it? You start it on paper. You start it on the street corner. You start speaking out. That's the war. That's the first shots, as far as I'm concerned. And they're being shot right now. So make no mistake about it. We're at war. And you just have to get into the battle. Now, if something happens with your neighbors and you see something going on, and they're doing something that's going to destroy life, liberty, or property, I think you have the right to intercede, even with deadly force. There's actually were laws on the books that said that if an officer of the law was proceeding outside of the law, that you could shoot him. And everybody goes, "Ah, well, that's the facts of life, brother." And so that's where I stand. Now, is it right? Just because it's right in that situation, does it mean it's going to go all over the place? No, because you're reacting to a set of circumstances that's happening now. That's why every case is its own case. You know, you know this precedence thing is every case has its own merits and they need to be examined. And who's going to examine them? We, the people, are going to examine them. So that's my answer. I don't know if I've helped you at all, but that's what I feel. It's more clear in my mind, and I'll know it when I see it. You know what I mean? I won't have to question it because it's going to be that dire. I'm in the battle now. You're in the battle. And the battle never stops. I hate to say it, but, you know, look at liberty requires vigilance. And part of that vigilance is whatever it takes to maintain it and to preserve it. Okay?
Gerard, somehow it said I could ask my question now. This is California Fred.
Wait. I want to give Brent an opportunity to comment on that because
I'm trying to say that you cut off the prior caller and gave me the cue, the mic.
Oh, I didn't touch it. I don't know. You know, this whole cue has been doing funny things tonight because it did change. Like he said, I didn't expect to be first, and he wasn't. When I went up there and hit the thing,
I didn't expect to be first, and he wasn't.
Unmuted.
Well, I can mute until you're finished with him or whenever you decide to unmute.
Yeah, I'm just going to give Brent a chance to answer that and see what he thinks. And then you're up here, so just mute yourself, and then we'll let you answer your question after Brent gets done.
Yeah, Eric needs to turn down his speakers or something. We're picking up a lot of feedback from Eric. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Gerard. I'll make a couple of comments. Gerard had said that, pick up where Gerard left off, Gerard had said that, oh, know what to do when the time comes, the circumstances are such that something is required to be done. That was more using paper and pen and ink and words. In that regard, there was a case down in Texas a year or two ago, I don't remember. A fellow was a pot smoker. He was no saint. And the police, I think they had a warrant, but they didn't follow the knock and enter. And he heard somebody bashing down his front door. He's in his bedroom. He grabbed his gun. He didn't know what to think. He was scared out of his wits. Bang, bang, boom, crash, through the door they come. And then the first man through his bedroom door caught a bullet and killed him. And, of course, they tried him for it, and he was acquitted. Now, if you do something like that, in his case, and by the way, they found pot and prosecuted him for a minor petty charge for marijuana, I think it was, or something. But they acquitted him of murder, a police officer. And in that's an extreme circumstance, and he didn't know what else to do. He acted in good faith, and it really happened. So those are the kind of circumstances where those things happen. I want to make a mention about our Declaration of 76, and I have to remind myself that's the reason we're going through this. It's a forgotten document. It gives us an outline of when to act. It provides a four-part test for recognizing when one must no longer tolerate government abuse. And I'm going to go through these four real quick. They're right in the Declaration of 76. But I want to say before I do also, this is my position, that as long as the courts are open, we seek redress in the courts. As long as the courts are open, and I know the judge is acting crazy, but as long as the courts are open, we keep going in. And if we keep going in, if we can get the jury impaneled, the jury will eventually, if they're doing their job, and usually they eventually will. You know, the juries are the ones that shut down prohibition. It wasn't a constitutional amendment that shut down. Oh, the constitutional amendment came, but that was after juries said, we're not going to allow this to go on anymore. We're not going to allow government to convict anybody anymore. We're tired of this. And they started going after the prosecutors. They wouldn't indict the people that were manufacturing and transporting booze without a license. They were going after the prosecutors who were trying to go after the people that were doing that because they saw that it wasn't working. Well, the public opinion and the critical mass of it arose, and eventually a constitutional amendment was passed to do away with the lawless madness of prohibition. And by the way, just to drop a footnote on that, prohibition is against the law of God. No place in God's written law is the revelation of his will. Does he ever delegate to men, the governments of men, the governments among men, the power to outlaw drugs and alcohol? It does say a lot that God reveals his opinion about that. He doesn't like it. He says it's dangerous. In many different ways he says it, but no place does he delegate criminal jurisdiction. You can see in the Bible, criminal jurisdiction is God has delegated to men, for example, for murder, killing out of vengeance. That's what murder is. Out of envy. That's what murder is. Get somebody out of the way. Well, that's Romans chapter 13. That's what that's all about. It's about murder and vengeance. Criminal jurisdiction among men that God has delegated. But drugs and alcohol, that's quite another matter. Let me go through these four tests. These are tests in our Declaration of 76, whereby we may know that it's time to stop toleration of government. Now, this is our law. This is our organic law. This is the real McCoy. This is the document that declared the authority for our country. Okay, here it is. I'm going to read it, and then just mention each one of these four. It says, but when a long train of abuse or patients, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them, that is, these colonies, under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government, and to provide new guards for their future security. Now, in that paragraph, that's paragraph 2, there are 4 things mentioned here. And I'll unpack them briefly here real quick. I'm going from this booklet by yours truly called The Declaration and the Constitution, Common Lawyer Comments, Clause by Clause. Number 1, this paragraph says, in hindsight, if the abuses and usurpations form a long train one after another, that's the first part of the test. All 4 of these, by the way, all 4 of these tests, these 4 parts must be present before men are justified in acting to stop a government abuse. In hindsight, abuses and usurpations must form a long train. That means one after another, all hooked together, uninterrupted. Number 2, this train must be headed for absolute despotism. So first, you've got to see this long train. Second, you've got to see that this train is headed for absolute despotism. Notice he does not say despotism. He says absolute despotism. This is a high standard. Number 3, this train must show no wandering from its heading. He uses the words pursuing invariably. Big fancy words. It just means this train doesn't wander from its course. It is headed, it's a long train, number 1, one after another, abuses and usurpations. Number 2, headed for absolute despotism. Number 3, headed in a way that it doesn't vary, it pursues straight at it despotism, absolute despotism. Number 4, this train of abuses and usurpations headed for absolute despotism must show a design to reduce the people under absolute despotism, must show a design. So there must be a train of abuses and usurpations. It says here, long train, not just a few, long train, abuses and usurpations, one after another, headed for absolute despotism, does not wander from its course. And when you look at it and you think it through, you see that this train of abuses and usurpations is a scheme. It's not just random abuses and usurpations. It is a design to reduce people under absolute despotism. 4 things. That's paragraph number 2 of our Declaration of 76. And right there he says that all experience has shown that men are patient, long-suffering, before they'll ever do anything. And that's true. And that's why he uses the word long train, not just a few. Are we there? Well, I think we're pretty close if we aren't. And people say, yes, but we're prosperous. We have it better than other people. Yes. And by the way, the 13 colonies were prosperous beyond belief. But that isn't what bothered them. They were getting along great. That's what made England so mad and envious, by the way. They were envious of the colonies because the colonies had so much, because they had been left alone for so long. King George I, King George II, they were from Germany. They were more interested in drinking German beer and their frows, their German girls. They'd come home for payday. Other than that, they never showed up in England hardly at all. They didn't have the American colonies during those days. Just did whatever they wanted. And what's the result of government leaving people alone? Prosperity. They had the common law in place. They were governing themselves. And they were envious, and so they went after them. So just because we're having it nice economically or better than others doesn't mean that we're... It's a matter of principle, friends, neighbors, and kin. You may have it nice, but do you want to put up with abuses? Abuses from government? Physical abuses. We jail more people than anybody in the world. So this is the test, and maybe we can go over this again sometime and unpack it a little more. I did that a long time ago here, but it's worth going back and reviewing. Thank you, Gerard. Back to you. Thanks for letting me respond.
Okay, Gerard, thank you, Brett.
Thank you. Okay. That helped from both of you.
Okay.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks a lot. I don't know what this crazy board's doing, but it's all over the place.
All right, I'm going to hit next. I don't know who's going to come up because Fred, oh, wait a minute. California Fred is unmuted, right, Fred?
Yeah, I'm still sitting here.
Okay, go ahead, buddy.
I didn't mean to upset the apple cart, but I had.
No, it wasn't you. It wasn't you.
Okay, but I had a question, like, for John and maybe you or even Brent. I don't know where this goes or maybe if National Liberty Alliance should get involved with this. Because apparently what they're doing is they are sending people to, quote, private prisons. Now, not only that, the IRS is hiring subcontractors. In other words, they're private individuals operating like IRS agents. Then we have the court system itself hiring attorneys to be to defend people. And my question is, where are these contracts? How can we get access to them? And why do these contracts not spell out that they defend us under the Constitution? And where is our Seventh Amendment so we can take these bastards down? I'll mute.
Gerard, are you in the mood to talk?
Well, look, they're privatizing everything. You're right. I mean, is it? And in some cases, I suppose it's legal, but in many cases, it's not. I mean, I know there are certain things that we can't give to others, like Congress can't give their duty to make money to the Federal Reserve, but they did it, right? So I don't know if this falls into that, but it certainly seems that, look, if you have a contract with somebody, they're supposed to be controlled by a contract. Now, can we contract our government away? I think that's up to the people. I don't think that's up to a government official to hire another somebody to do his job. I don't know the answer to that, but it sounds fugazi to me. And it's a way that government, I know from experience, that these private contractors go into countries, like in the case of Blackwater, that they commit atrocities, and then the American government goes, well, that's not us. That's that corporation there that just went out of business. That's a problem. So in my mind, there's a problem with that. I don't know what you think about that, Brent.
Well, it's a problem. I want to say this because I've been through a lot of hardship over this particular problem, and I suppose I'm just saying to myself at this point, I need to say something about it, and I'm glad for the opportunity. Well, anyway, what I was going to address was the idea of hiring attorneys, the government hiring attorneys to help people, and they are under contracts, federal defenders, for example, a lawyer, a law firm will get a contract defend all the people in the federal court. And this contract is at the pleasure of the judge. In other words, if you don't please the judge, you're going to lose your contract. And these contracts are not small. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars these lawyers get. They get, I remember that was back 10 years ago, involved in a case in the federal public defender is coming back to me. For every case he got $3,000 on the table up front. And then he was paid by the hour. He billed by the hour after that. And, of course, a couple hundred bucks an hour. And don't do anything. And I finally got this particular federal public defender on the witness stand because he sold a client of mine, a former client, down the river. He's working with the federal prosecutor. This is common, not uncommon. Working with the federal prosecutor to make their job easy, sold him down the river, and then ended up with the Speedy Trial Act. They do that with the Speedy Trial Act. Just keep prolonging the trial, filing motions to go to the federal prosecutor wants them to. Well, he did all that, got him on the witness stand, and I asked him, cross-examination, have you ever tried a case? He was bragged about how long, how long he'd been doing it. I don't know, 20 years he'd been a federal public defender. Have you ever tried a case? And the answer was no, he'd never tried a case. Never. Never took a case to trial that whole time. Well, he ended up getting sued for slander, and the case got crazier because of what he had said to his client that had been assigned to him. He got so upset with his client that he went screaming out of the office. I can't repeat it. Oh, I can repeat it here. Am I going to? It wasn't fit for anybody's ears to hear what he was saying. Well, so this fellow sued him for slandering him. And it was the kind of thing where he could sue him, and he accused him. You know, there's a couple of things in the law of slander, generally speaking, that you can sue people for, and you don't even have to prove damages. Damages are presumed. One of them is if somebody accuses you of a loathsome venereal disease, a loathsome sexual disease. They accuse you of having one. You don't have to prove damages in that case. And the other one is if they demean you in your profession, whether you're a carpenter or a lawyer or a preacher or whatever you are. Run you down, make a statement to a third party. Well, damages are presumed there, too. Well, he got sued. Thing ended up going to the federal appellate court. And the question before the federal appellate court was, is this guy suable for slander? He claims sovereign immunity. Why? He's an agent of the government. And my argument back was, now, wait a minute. If he's an agent of the government's prosecuting his client for a crime. That sounds like a conflict of interest to me. I don't know. Am I stupid? Maybe I'm the dumb one here. You know, that's where. And apparently I was. Now, on the three-judge panel, one of them got to really question the other two who were against me and said, now, wait a minute, what he's asking is, and he'd say what he was asking. And they argued back and forth and asked me questions, and I said, well, it seems plain to me that he's got to make a choice. Every lawyer has to have undivided loyalty, and how could he be paid by the government? And then they say he's an agent, and he's not. Therefore, you can't sue him, an agent of the government, while at the same time, he's an agent defending his client against the government. That's what attorney means. It's an old word that means agent. You hire an attorney, you give him a scope of authority, and he acts on your behalf. He's an agent, fiduciary obligation. Well, the court did what it does sometimes. It ruled against me and then decreed that the opinion that it wrote would be unpublished and unusable for precedent. That's the way it sometimes works. So what do you do in cases like that? That's not a meaningful response, in my humble opinion, and I believe they're wrong. Now, I guess the problem is if people can't afford a lawyer, who's going to provide one? That, see, is the ultimate problem. But I don't think it's the thing to do to break law and deny and just say, well, that doesn't matter here in this case. Divided loyalty doesn't matter. It doesn't. And that then makes the officer of the court, the lawyer, it demeans his position and makes him ineffective and ruins his ability to properly defend anybody. If he's working for the judge, and the judge, by the way, is an employee of government, lest we ever forget. And that's a dangerous position to... That's why we have juries, for crying out loud, because the judge is an employee of government. That's what Justice Scalia points out. He's not blind, and other people should. Let's talk about this, and let's get it out of the open. Let's not hide it like the appellate court did and say, well, yeah, but we don't want to talk about it. No, we need to talk about it. Time has come, boys and girls. Let's talk. Why is it hobby horses. Anyway, Gerard, go ahead.
I go one further, Brent. I think the fact that he's an agent makes the state liable for his wrongdoing. They can even pay the damages.
No, if they're going to say that, that's right.
Right.
If they're going to say that, that's right. But he left his scope of authority. He's open to think.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Brent. And Fred, I don't know if that answers your question anymore, but that's the best we're going to do tonight.
That you did fine. Thank you very much, Brent and Gerard. I'll talk to you next week, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Fred.
Okay, the next one in the queue is Felicia from Florida. How you doing, Felicia?
How you doing?
Good.
I have a couple questions. I'm going to kind of ask them first, and maybe you guys can get some I've been listening. And the first one is, can you file a written error in a eviction case on a local level before filing on a federal case? Second one is there a statute of limitations file a non-judicial foreclosure in the state in the state of Florida. Because when I read the website, it said you have to actually file them on the local record first. And of course, I been listening and realized that justice don't have the street. And all y'all researching climate change is a lie. And what has been done about Judge Kahn on the non-judicial foreclosures, and have you guys seen the documentaries about the film that's not going to come out called Great State about FEMA and martial law? That's okay.
I had a real hard time hearing you, Felicia. There's like a buzzing that's coming through. I don't know if it's my computer or if anybody else hears that, but when you were talking, there was a buzzing. Oh,
well,
what'd you do? There you go.
I asked again. Okay, I've been listening tonight. Can you file a writ of error in a non-judicial foreclosure case on a local level before filing a federal case? Because I read on a website that you have to actually file on a local level before you actually file on a federal level. The second question is there a statute of limitations to file a non-judicial foreclosure in any case in the state of Florida? And then I said judges are magistrates. I learned that. And are y'all researching climate change lies? And the last one, have you guys seen a trailer for the movie Gray State that's not going to come out because something happened? And it's about FEMA and martial law.
No, I the last one first, I wasn't, it's called Great State or Gray State?
Gray State.
I wasn't aware of that, maybe. And it's not going to come out, huh?
No, something happened, and I want to get into it. I watched about it, and it's not coming out. But he has a trailer for it, and they did a lot of things about it, and it's not coming out. It's just
Too much truth at the wrong time is what it is.
Yeah, it was too much truth, and unfortunately, his wife and his daughter is deceased.
Oh, wonderful. Well, listen, the other question you have about, do you have to file in the state court before you go to the federal court? And there's a simple answer to that. Look, yes, you can file a writ of error in any case. I've done them in the local court in New York State. But, I mean, look, if the judge makes an error, you file a writ of error. But they can't tell you that you have to do it in the state court first. I mean, I think it's a good idea to let the judge know what his writ of error is. A writ of error is a writ of error on that judge. How could you go into a federal court and file a writ of error? You could file the writ of error from the state court, the local court, up in the federal court because he violated a constitutionally protected right, and there he's liable for collateral damage. You don't have to keep appealing it. See, what you're asking is, they say, oh, well, you haven't exhausted your remedies in the state court, so you can't go to federal court. Well, that's not true, because when they violate a constitutional right, the only court that can answer that is a federal court, because it's a conflict for the state court. The state court can't give you remedy unless they're going to give you what you want. You see what I'm saying? Because they're like the judge, jury, and executioner. They're the ones that you're going against, and the place for that is in the federal court. So that's all a bunch of hogwash to keep you down in the lower courts. I don't think you'll ever get a state court to give you a ruling in your favor unless the judge is having a bad day or a good day, or he's getting ready to retire or something, because they just won't do it, you know? I mean, not that they couldn't do it in your favor, but they can't do it against you because they got a conflict. How's he going to rule or give you remedy when they're the ones doing the harm, you know? And when it comes to constitutional violations like that, there is no statute of limitations as far as I know. You know, they violated an inalienable right. that's a serious charge. You know, there's no statute of limitations on murder. Now, if it's not a criminal case, if it's a money case or something like that, I suppose there could be a statute of limitations because, you know, you wait too long with things and records get lost and people forget. So I don't know. I just know that if they're violating an unalienable right, I don't believe that there's a statute of limitations on that. If you look at the IRS, they say if there's fraud, they can go back any number of years. The statute doesn't apply to them. I think at least that should apply to us, too. That's my answer, anyway.
I'm talking about in a non-judicial foreclosure in an eviction case, because when I went to the website, they said you have to file it in a local court first before going federal, and that was on a federal website. I can remember.
You got to look at, if you're going to go into federal court, you have to go for cause, and they want to see what your cause is. And we just recently did this, and of course they like statutes. So there are U.S. codes that are statutes, and one of them applies to you. And in a non-judicial foreclosure, you know, they've already done it. They've already violated your rights, and you can jump right into the federal court. I don't care what the federal court says. You got to put down what the harm was, what the cause was, and then they'll take it up. You know, what, you're going to appeal to the tyrant that beat you? You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't make sense. And yes, they will try to get rid of stuff by kicking it back down, saying that you didn't exhaust your administrative remedies or whatever in the lower court, but I don't believe that in those cases that they can do that. I mean, what's the guy that we have on the website there? I'm having a senior moment with the common law there. He says they're subject to collateral suit. That means that you don't need to go through all their appeals when it's a direct violation of a constitutional unalienable right.
Well, they are, you know, picking me up the house and the guy fixed my house up that I had built, and he's renting it out for $1,400 a month. And it's like, I don't even have nowhere to go, really.
Well, it's all fraud. The federal court's going to try to get away with that because they don't want to answer it, because that case, you see, when those are hard cases for them to answer. I mean, usually if you write a good case and you send it up there, a lot of times they'll call the lower judge and they'll say, get this case out of my court, which means settle with you, because that judge doesn't want to stick his neck out for something that they botched up at the state level. You know what I mean? So I don't know. You look at, you're reading the instructions, and the instructions are telling you you have to file it in the state court first because they're treating it as an appeal, right?
I don't know.
Well,
what you're doing. I just read it and I was like, wow.
Yeah,
and I've actually, you know, submitted the grand jury's documents, you know, right before, the day before they kicked me out. And the officer that was going to kick me out, he called me because I told him, I was like, you're violating my due process of law. And then the next day, he called me and he's like, okay, we're here to, you know, get you out of house. Are you there? And I was like, no. I was sitting right there at the park, and I videotaped the whole thing. Like, they wanted to arrest me.
Of course.
And I was like, okay. And then to make it so bad is that the local police officers that I know actually came to my job and told me, your car is parked outside. You need to come get it. They, like, tried to put me on a property so they can arrest me, and neighbors was like, police officers, you know, everybody's in at your house, you know, they're sticking out. And it's like, no, not going back there. You're not going to arrest them.
So that means that they were afraid of you and your ability.
These people I know, these local officers I know. But I talked to the sheriff's office, and I went up there. I submitted my documents to them, to the sheriff's office beforehand. They ignored it. The judge ignored it. Everybody ignored it. And then for me to actually see the same officer that I know and be in contact with on a daily basis, you know, these were the people at my house. It's like, really? You trying to arrest me? And then, you know, for them weeks later, you know, I had gave my old car to somebody. They never picked it up. And they came to the local police officers came to my job. It's like, you need to remove your car or they're going to remove it. And my neighbors have been telling me that they was staking out at my house. It's like, they want to catch me on the property. I could be on the sidewalk on the property. But it's just a fact of the matter, you know.
Yeah, I don't know what game they were playing, except for one thing. There's only one reason they would want to arrest you to local police is because they're thinking that you're going to take a case out against that judge in federal court. And guess what? They're all liable. Everybody that carried that out under the color of law, they're all suable for that. They all have to answer for that. Everybody, look at you. You gave letters to the sheriff, and he went ahead and he ignored it, and you pointed the law out to him, and he basically upheld a non-judicial foreclosure, an unconstitutional, you know, usurpation of the law. So every officer that had a part of that is liable. That's why this sheriff things we're doing is so important, because these sheriffs don't realize that they're putting themselves and their deputies in harm's way, because when the people wake up and they take this stuff to court, guess what? Every one of those guys is liable for that action under color of law. That's and maybe they're starting to realize that, and that would be the only impetus that I could see of why they would want to put you in jail, to try to take the wind out of your sails, so that, you know, if you're not there and you didn't do anything and they can't arrest you and they can't control you. In other words, they want to control you because they're afraid of the next paper you might file. That's what I think.
Yeah, and then what's so funny is, you know, one of the local officers, you know, I told him I'm about to get kicked out. You know, they stole my house that I had built and everything. And one of the local officers was like, come stay with me. I stayed with him for 2 days. And he was trying to convince me to go back, and I was like, listen, I was in the police academy at one point. I'm not that stupid. And I videotaped them. That sheriff called me, Miss Collins, you know, here to turn over the house. He's like, where are you? We're knocking on the door. And I'm like, I'm not there. I was sitting there looking at them the whole time. And I have it on video. It's like, I couldn't even believe the same officer that I knew, and I, you know, you trying to put me in jail, really? And I call the officer. It's like, why is they trying to arrest me? Oh, they're just doing their job. That was his answer.
Well, don't forget, when it comes to somebody exercising a lien or anything like that, the sheriff makes money on that stuff. He gets a percentage of the value of. And so, in a certain sense, he's got a conflict too, right? Because if he upholds the law, he won't get his cut then, right?
Yes, sir.
So if he upholds the law in your case, then that means he's not going to be getting too many more cases after that. What do you
mean? No. This sheriff for Lake County, down here where I'm at in Tavares, he needs to be removed because he violated, if he's a constitutional officer, he violated all those constitutional officers.
So when's he up for election again?
I don't know, but he needs to be removed immediately.
Well, look, at what he did is chargeable. You could actually, it's tortable. It's treasonous. You know what I mean? There's a lot of different things of the laws that he broke. I mean, he's no better than you know, what the court did to you and what the bank did or whoever else it was.
The court did, the bank did. I have a whole list of names, and I even have, I went to a local lawyer here, and I went to my storage today, and I seen a document from a local lawyer, and he said because of the people involved, so many people involved, that we were not going to take your case. So.
Right. Well,
I don't want to hold up the line.
Made an impression, and you know, look, at you got to do what you have to do, and put your paperwork in, because if it, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. If you don't complain, you don't put the paperwork in, nothing can happen. Things are starting to change, and all that paperwork, just like our paperwork that's in on Judge Kahn. Listen, we indicted Judge Kahn. They're not listening to it right now, but we're sending the magistrate a show cause of why, you know, for not acting and putting that judge in his place who usurped our case. So that's what's going in now. But Judge, I mean, they're still taking our paperwork. They're still putting it on the docket. So he didn't really close the case down. That's a lie. You know what I mean? So.
Well, what I can say about that is man can manipulate law, and they can put people in different circumstances like they did me, because I was trying to live the American dream. But I always say that man has no power. It's a manipulation of power. God has all the power.
That's right.
So there's statutes, laws, and all that. But in the end, you know, I really didn't know about inalienable rights, you know, because I was never taught that. But I'm understanding.
Well, persistence, too. Don't forget. You know, you have to persevere. You have to keep putting your stuff in. And right now, I think they're starting to get worried because the tide is turning. And people are waking up, and they're all liable for their crimes. Make no mistake about it, it's all crimes.
Ever since I was evicted, none of those officers have came up to the job that they used to come to every day.
Yeah, well, see, that's right. So they know something, right?
They do.
Yeah, I believe it. Anyway.
Okay, hey, Mr. Dan. Good to hear his voice.
Yeah, okay. Have a good night.
Right, that's Sammy. You as well.
Thank you. Yeah. Good night. God bless. Okay. Next questioner, you've been unmuted. Marva from GA, I guess that's Georgia.
Yes, I have a question. Actually, I have a couple questions, but let me just ask this one because it's most immediate. I received a traffic ticket in which... it was a false claim. It was appealed to the Superior Court. I went to court on Monday and then was told to come back on Tuesday because they were overcrowded. And it basically got continued. The judge was somewhat rude, but that's not the part I want to address. So I left out and I realized I didn't get a note for having appeared. And the reason why it was particularly important was the DA was trying to allege that I had not been there. So I just wanted to have it on paper, sealed, as proof. Left out of there, and when I realized that I didn't have the note, I wanted to get the note. And there was no one downstairs at the windows at the clerk's. Plus, before they said you have to get it from the clerk inside the court. So I was in the hallway, and a bailiff came. He was going in the court. I told him what I needed. He said, wait. He was going to do something. Came back out, and he was telling me that I wasn't supposed to be there. He alleged that the judge ordered me to be out of the courthouse, which that didn't happen. And he told me to leave. Next thing I know, he's grabbed my arm, putting me in handcuffs, says, I touched you, now I got to take you to jail. He pushes me downstairs, meaning he's holding my arm, assaulting me. I want to use the right terminology. So he's taking me downstairs on the elevator, get downstairs to the security guard, and the security guard is like, what's going on? I explain to him that I just need to get a note saying, validating that I was in court the day before and that day. And he said, well, just don't worry about it. Maybe he'll just let it go and you can leave. The guy comes back, grabs my arm again. He's trying to find someone else to go with him to take me across the street, he said. Short story is he actually takes me before a magistrate. He initially alleged disorderly conduct. Then he started creating stories. At the end of all things, the charge was disorderly conduct, resisting officer, and trespass, and with a $1,500 bond. I'm scheduled to be in court on Thursday about it. While I was in court, while I was in jail, which I was in jail until Sunday morning, while I was in jail, the next day after the night, I was taken for what they call a 96-hour hearing. That particular hearing, it was a judge, which I had gone to court with the one that's in the Superior Court now, and I stood up and moved for a continuance. He held me in contempt and on no bond. So I moved for him to recuse himself. He refused. Then he was like, sit down. You need to sit down. And so I stated, who I was, that I wished to, and I always identify myself as a woman, and that I wished to secure my own counsel. He wanted me to sign the paperwork. I signed as I normally do, reserving my rights, UCC 1-308RR without prejudice, and UDTC under duress coercion. And so he wanted the guard to look at it from the jail. She looked at it, and then he told them to bring me over to the jail, over to the court. So I was taken over to the court, or at the court, and went through the same thing. And he then assigned a court-appointed attorney, which I never asked for. I objected to that, of course. Then nothing happened the next day. Then the next day, the senior district court judge called me over to the court, and I was taken over to the court, taken over at the court, and the court-appointed attorney was sitting in a room and wanted to talk to me first. So she had printed out charges, the different charges and their definition or the information about them, as well as charges that are now appealed in the Superior Court, and she alleged that she had also been appointed as the court-appointed attorney for that matter, which that was beyond me. So she basically was telling me why the charges were valid. And she wanted my personal information at saying she needed it for my file. And then she stated that she was going to make a recommendation for an eval. And I told her, I said, I, woman Marva, and you, woman Vicky, I will hold you liable for any injury, damage, or harm to me. I fire you. So we went into the courtroom, or at the courtroom, I'm not sure how to say that, before the senior district court judge. Basically, the same thing happened. I say that I fired her. He told me that I could not fire her. And he then, I told him that I wished to secure my own counsel. He wanted me, again, to sign the paperwork. I signed the paperwork the same way. He stated he wanted me to sign the name, sign my full name. And he... And so he said, if you don't sign the name, I'm holding you contempt. I hold you in contempt 30 days. And then he said, if you sign the name the way that I'm telling you to sign the name, I will withdraw the contempt charge. He then commenced to, and so I stated again that I wish to secure my own counsel. I was there in honor and peace, and that I fired the court-appointed attorney. He said, no, you're not firing her. I'm removing her, or I'm withdrawing her. He then instructed the court-appointed attorney and the bailiff to take me up to the third floor to the Superior Court in front of Judge Talley and to instruct her that I had been before Michael Stone, who's the judge, and also him, and I failed to follow the instruction to sign my name. So got up to the Superior Court, and it was called. I stated again that I had fired the court-appointed attorney. Judge Talley told me, hush. And so then she asked the court-appointed attorney why I was there, because I had been there earlier in the week and the case was continued, and why was I dressed in jail clothes. And so the attorney began to talk. I objected because she doesn't have any firsthand information, plus I had fired her. The judge again told me to hush, be quiet. I objected, let the record show. And so then she was telling the judge what the charges were. The judge asked her if she wanted to withdraw. She stated that she did. She asked if I had any objection to her to withdraw. I told her I had fired her. And she was like, hush, don't you say anything. Just answer the question that I asked. She asked the question or restated it again. I said no. And then she turned to the DA and asked the DA, well, she said to the DA, we've already continued this until February, correct? He says, correct. Then I moved for consideration to continue it to March or April. And DA had no problem with that, and it was granted. So my question is, I know there are a whole lot of unlawful things there. One, I know it's reasonable to ask for a note for especially appearing at court, and I'm not clear on how it could be a trespass when I was there at the court, and the courtroom is on the third floor. There's no way to get out of the courthouse.
Okay.
And plus, the judge never said that. So what does that all mean, and how do I handle that?
What it means is, do you want to fight or do you want to win? You're in their court where they have the guns and they don't like you. I mean, this all stems from a traffic charge, right?
Correct. Which
yes.
It's also invalid that they wrote on an
It's all invalid. What the real question is how much time and energy do you have to fight these people? I mean, you're at war with these people over a traffic ticket, and they're putting you in jail for 2 days, 30 days, whatever, because their whole thing is to break you. In other words, they don't like you. I mean, and so if you want to just prove a point, your points are well taken. I mean, they don't want to hear it. I mean, you know, you understand that you're being violated, and you're fighting them in this Nizzy Prius court that really has no jurisdiction over you, but because you're going through these motions, and they're there, and they have your body, they have you in custody, so you can't win. They got you strapped down. They're handcuffing you. They're throwing you in the jail, and you know. I appreciate the fight that you're doing, but if you don't have 500 people out the door rooting for you, you're not going to win. That's the facts of the matter. Look at these guys control.
Okay, so what are we supposed to do? I mean,
I would never make a fight in front of the judge. What you should have done is you should have made your fight in paperwork in the beginning. You know,
I did.
You know, no, I mean, I'm like saying you have to be like water. You have to flow. And so when you see that they're resisting you, you have to let it go, because they're going to put you in jail. They don't care. They're going to teach you a lesson. And so now it goes from one thing to the next thing. And before you know it, you're sitting in jail for 6 months and everybody forgets about what the original thing you're fighting was. So, you know, it's like Bill Thornton says, you know, he says, look, there's nothing so frightful as ignorance in action. Your story is a nightmare, quite frankly. I feel like it's really a nightmare. And I don't know what to tell you. We're kind of out of time now, but you can fight each little thing, but don't forget, you're fighting them in their court where they're in control, and they're not going to give you remedy. So you have to take it out into a federal court now, and now you got three judges involved. You got police officers. You got clerks. You got this whole battle going with little old you. You know, it's not like you even have a bunch of people showing up in you know, to defend you, because look, make no mistake about it. Like Thornton says, a court is a showroom. It's an act. Mm-hmm. The king used to hold court to justify cutting the guy's head off to let the people know that this guy did the wrong thing and the king was right in putting him to death and stuff. So the court was just a big show for the people. It's still just a big show. And so you're going through all this drama for what? You know, first of all, you should be out of that court and you shouldn't be fighting it on paper. When you go in there, they got control over you. I don't know. You know, it's like, you know, when you go into a den of lions and there's a bunch of lions and you don't even have a knife to fight them with, it's suicide. You know
what
I mean?
Well, what do you mean by fighting with paper? I mean, I did admit documents into the record.
Well, when I say fighting them by paper, you go ahead and you declare the court and you make the case, and you either take it out of that court because they can't give you remedy and you bring it into the federal court, you know, but you're not standing there in front of the judge making this fight. You're making it on paper. You get, like you did get them to release you till March or April. That gives you all that time to put paperwork in. If you put enough paperwork in, they may get sick of you. They may kick the case out just to get rid of you. That's your only hope. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, look at this thing. All stemmed, I don't know, over what kind of traffic infraction, but it's ballooned into, you know, where they're going to get you up for criminal charges here. Before you know it, they're going to sentence you to 10 years prison if they can. You know?
No, I mean, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. What I'm asking is, what should the process be that someone would take when something like this happens? This is unlawful. It happens to me in this case, but it's happening to a whole lot of other people. So, I mean, we know that they're crooked, but there must be things that we are able to do or should do. So that's why I'm asking. I'm a member of
the NLA. The best advice I can give you is as far as everything that's happened that's illegal, you put it down in an affidavit, with a sworn statement, and make a record of it. You know, I don't know where you'll get action. I mean, something like this, you're going to have to take it to another court. And then you got all these separate little incidences that happen afterwards. The security guard, the cop, the security guard, you know what I'm saying? Those are all separate instances. So you're going to be writing a lot of paperwork for a lot of people. You can't even put it all to the – I don't even know how you make it all the same case, because it's like different people violating your rights at different times in different places. And each one is a separate case. You know, I mean, you'll be tied up for 10 years, girl. Yeah, I don't know, but make an affidavit. The original, I mean, maybe put it on the original person that caused the whole thing. When you know what I'm saying? When you first went there, they didn't give you redress, and now it ballooned into this other thing. I don't know, but you just articulated it pretty good. You should write it down. And you should go get it notarized as an affidavit, and then, you know, I don't know where you can submit it. Look, you can make you can file complaints on judges. They don't like that, but you know if you think the judge was out of hand or whatever, you should file a complaint on him. You know, I mean, like we just went through in this call talking about how hard it is to sue a judge. You know, was he operating in his judicial role or not? Did he leave his judicial role? You know, he's sitting up there on the bench. He's the boss. You know, now he's over there holding you in contempt. I don't know what to tell you about that, because you entered in, you know, the main thing with people who are patriots and do the man on the land stuff is they don't want to get in their courts, because that's like going down to meet the devil. You know, come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. Well, you're in their web, and they have control over you, and that's a problem. You need to figure out how to cut those webs and drop out of there and keep your head low and get through, because these guys look at they have a mandate from the state. It is his court. He's sitting there, and they do control you. So unless you're some kind of a celebrity or you got a big following, they're not going to listen to you. You know, yes, you can file all kinds of paperwork, but you're going to be very busy for a long time. And I don't know what your original ticket was, but you know, for $100 or whatever, you could have avoided this whole scenario. You know, and I mean, I'm not telling you to lay down. I'm just telling you to pick your battles. That's all. And look, we're out of time. We got to go. It's been good, everybody. Thank you very much. And I'm already 10 minutes over my time. We need to have a good night, and let's stop this recording because it's already too long, and we're going to have to do some editing here otherwise. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you here same time next week. Have a good night, and God bless.